So this morning we're going to talk about torts. We've mentioned torts a few times before, but I want to tell you a little bit more about that because it is relevant in the construction world. The beginning of my career as a construction attorney, I did principally what's called insurance defense work, which was when architects, and I represented 95% was representing architects and engineers, and they would get sued for breach of contract, which would be under their insurance, but they would also be sued if there was someone injured. So I did a lot of injury, people falling off of buildings and so forth, people getting injured once the building's been constructed, etc. So those are torts, and so we're going to talk a little bit about that. Then we're going to talk about something called indemnity and contribution, and those are legal concepts. And while there are, and you'll see in some of the questions that I give you at the end when we talk about those, there are legal issues that are going to be in the way the exam's written because it's a construction law class and construction business class the second half. There are some legal topics that I don't really get heavily into. I just want you to understand them. There may be one on that, so that's the contribution indemnity. And then we're going to talk about insurance. And so again, insurance is very light on the exam. But if these are all relevant to your practice, so I want to make sure you're there. But they all get into more, like I said, legal issues, and so it's not as heavy in the way the exam is written. And we'll talk more about that at the end of a class. All right, so negligence and tort. So, definition of a tort. Now, a tort is an injury, and an injury can have all different types of forms. It's not just a physical injury. There can be different ways, and we'll go through exactly what they are. And negligence is when you guys don't perform to your standard of care. So we have here, tort is an act or omission, so the person that's committing the tort has either act or failed to act. And in architecture, it's more of the omission than it is the act, because a lot of times maybe in your design you failed to put something in. So with maybe you didn't do the right calculations, so it went in there. So it was an omission. It gives rise to injury or harm. And that's where people like, it's not just I got my arm broken or something like that. Harm to another, and amounts to a civil wrong for which the courts impose liability. So going back, you know, hundreds and thousands of years when we were back to the feudal ages and the kings and queens and stuff, people for doing good deeds were awarded land, and people for doing things that were bad, actually their land could be taken away. And so it became, you had to figure out, how do we remedy people that have been unjustly harmed? They have to have some type of civil remedy. A crime may not have been committed. I mean, if there's a crime, then obviously the person who committed the crime is going to go to jail. But that doesn't mean that the person who was injured has no recourse for it. And so they created this concept of law of torts. And so it's been around for as long or longer than breach of contract stuff, but it's to right a wrong that's outside of the criminal side. And you're going to find a lot of things when we get a couple of lists of what a tort is. They're very parallel to criminal crimes, what are considered a tort is. But you are allowed to be compensated for that if you bring an action in court. Now, similar to contracts, a tort includes a duty owed, and in this case, if you remember from early lectures, we talked about the law is up to protect the public and society. And so, it's a duty owed to society. You may not owe it to an individual, some specific individual, you owe it to everyone in general. And so, that way, you don't have to have a contract with that individual if they are injured or harmed, because you owe it to everyone in society. And it's imposed by law to act in an acceptable manner. We all want to act reasonably. And what becomes a tort and what's considered ultimately, or not ultimately, but many times is going to go to the jury of the peers. Did this person act unreasonably? And was the manner of them acceptable or not? And that's going to say whether they in fact were negligent. So you get this, and any jury can make a decision one way or the other. And that's the same in the criminal law. You have a different standard. One is criminal is beyond a reasonable doubt. In negligence and tort, you only have to have a preponderance. So 51% or above. So it's a lower standard, but still it's to take care of you. Okay. What's the difference between a loss from a breach of contract and a loss in tort? Because we have these two different things where you could have losses. And in some instances, there can be a breach of contract and there can be a tort for the exact same harm or injury. It just depends on who's the person or party that's bringing that claim. So, a lawsuit or breach of contract is defined by the obligation agreed to between the two parties. So we have these specific, within the four corners of the contract, we have these specific duties, we have these specific obligations that the parties owe to each other. You remember, duty, breach of duty, you had to have consideration and the other specific elements of a contract breach. We talked about that. And there's a slide on the elements of a contract breach. And we'll have one here on the elements of torts. But the contract can narrow things. So there may be things that you as an individual don't owe to the whole society, but your contract says you owe to this individual the payment of money for services. Like a doctor does not have an obligation to walk around and heal every person they see. But a doctor has an obligation if a patient comes to them, because there becomes this de facto agreement between them, and that doctor owes a duty of care and performs the services for that individual. So that's a contract, even though there's no written contract between you and the doctor, and they can be negligent at the same time. Now, a loss to a tort is not contractually based. It's, did you act negligently? Did you act reasonably? And it's going to be the society that tells you whether you acted negligently or not. Now, lots of cases over the years, and remember in the hierarchy, down at the bottom, there's common law and case law. That will start to establish precedent. You may have heard the word precedent. That will establish precedent as to what is considered a tort and not a tort. So you don't have to just rely on each and every case individually. Like, oh, that sounds like one today, that doesn't sound like one tomorrow. You have hundreds of years of cases defining that in written common law. And those are the way, when you get to the end of a civil trial, you will write jury instructions that are based on what the law, how it exists, to give some framework for the jury to make that decision. But it's still the question of whether you acted negligently and what has become negligent. So, the overlap, there is an actual overlap between contract law and tort law. And it's what's called, it falls under this word of an economic loss rule. Remember when I just said, I said, you could have a contract with an individual and there could be a loss from that. I'm supposed to design the house properly. I didn't design the wall properly. The wall falls down and there's an injury. Is the injury due to a person? Could be. Is the injury due to the fact that the wall has crumbled and now the house is coming down? Could be as well. So that is a tort because there's a harm and a loss. What would happen, though, under the economic loss rule, and you won't be tested on the economic loss rule, I just wanted to mention that's where there's this overlap, is if you have a contract in architecture or construction and the wall falls down, your claim against the architect or the contractor, if they built the wall improperly, is a breach of contract claim. You cannot bring a tort claim if you have a contract with them in the construction world. That's the economic loss rule. If you try to bring that tort claim, or you try to get outside of the obligations of the contract, the economic loss rule says, nope, not allowed. However, a third party can bring that tort claim. So if the wall falls down and injures someone, that person wasn't in contract with you. It's the same issue, the wall falling down, it's due to a design failure. I'm the person working on the project site, I'm just an electrician there, and the wall falls down and breaks my leg. But I, as the electrician, don't have a contract with you as the designer. I have a contract with the general contractor, who's a contractor with the owner, who's over there with the designer. So there's no line connecting this injured worker to the architect way over here. So the architect sues, the injured worker sues the architect in tort, saying you as an architect owe to society to design competently, reasonably, and not negligently, and your negligence injured me. The economic loss rule is about the people that are in the chain of contract can't bring that tort claim. They can only bring a breach of contract claim. So, does that make sense? You have a question?
So
so if there's an injured worker Their claim is, you as an architect, or they'll probably sue both the architect and the contractor, and probably even sue their boss, and that would be under a workers' compensation claim, because in America we sue everybody. You want to cover your basis, you're not sure why you got injured, so you'll sue everybody and sort it out as we go along. But the duty that's going to be alleged as the architect owed a duty to society to make sure that they designed properly. The contract between the architect and the owner says, in written terms, I, architect, must perform to the standard of care. That's a contractually written duty. The injured worker is going to say, architect, you were supposed to perform to the standard of care. They're going to say the same words, because the standard of care is this concept that the standard of care is set for what you owe everybody, but when you write it in a contract, you know you have that obligation. And so what ends up happening is, in both instances, and that's why I'm not going to test you on this, but it's the hard part to grasp when you first get into construction law, is the fact that the standard of care is a negligence standard which could lead to a tort if you fail to perform in accordance with standard of care, but becomes contractually obligated when it's in a written contract. So that's where the overlap that goes over. But at the same time, if you have that written contract, you don't want to go around the circle and try to do it in tort. And the reason why it comes into that, and I'll just give you one example of a case that I worked on really early in my career, and this is the first time I'm like, oh my God, I don't understand this. That's why, of course, I would never test you, because it took me a while. I had to write a couple articles about it, finally. Is I represented an architect who had designed... There's a large condo complex, townhomes, I guess you would call it, at the where Lincoln comes up, and I'm trying to remember the cross street. But it's like, you know, Lincoln Avenue, I don't know how many of you guys have ever lived in the city of Chicago, Lincoln Avenue is a diagonal street. There's this big wedge piece of property, and it's this really nice, upscale, high-end townhome complex. I wish I could remember the name of it. But in any event, the way the architect had designed the parapet wall, and it was all the buildings were like three-story walk-ups and everything else, the parapet wall, is they leaked. And the water leaked in, and it came in and ruined the floors. Now, there was leakage elsewhere, too, and so the owners of the condos and working with the condo association brought a claim against the architect, and they said, you breached your contract, because they assumed the rights and obligations of the contract, and it ruined our floors. That was one of the many claims that they had. The architect was responsible for the defects of the under contract. The architect was responsible for the cost to repair the defects to the wall parapet. You had to take it apart, you had to fix it, because it was designed improperly, it was built as designed, so you had to rip it apart and rebuild it with the new design. And the architect was responsible for those costs. But the damage that happened to the floors was not the architect's duty, because the architect's duty owed the design to properly design the parapet wall. And the floors became a different claim, because you had these floors and there was leakage and everything else, and so the architect didn't have that worked on the parapet wall didn't have an obligation to how the floors work. And so we couldn't have a breach of contract claim there, even though it was the water leaking in from the house. And so the contractor, the condo association, tried to bring it as a tort claim. You injured my home, and you had to pay for these floors. And the architect won under this economic loss rule that said you could only bring a contract for what they were specifically required to do, which was design the parapet wall. And those were called consequential damages, which we talked a little bit more about last week. And so the economic loss rule is kind of this weird thing where the architect can get some protection. There are some exceptions of it, suddenly claim it's loss or some other things. Again, you don't have to worry about it at all. But it's an overlapping area where you have a negligence standard and you have a contract standard, but the negligence standard isn't overcoming in everything else. It's only what you're contractually obligated, and this architect was only contractually obligated to design the parapet wall properly and not worry about what happens with the floors. So, again, don't worry about it for the exam. I just wanted to tell you it may come up in your career, may not. If you're ever there and you have some weird case and your contract, and your lawyer says, oh, this falls under the economic loss rule, you can say, oh, I remember hearing about that way back, 100 years ago. Hannah told me about it, and I don't remember what it was because he said I didn't have to remember. So, but at least the words will make you'll have heard the words before. Okay, purpose of tort law. This is the same as contract law. This is pretty easy. Promote safety. You got to make sure you perform to the standard of care. Promote predictability of behavior. Remember the contracts we talked about is to predict the future. And so this is predictability of behavior. If we all are supposed to be acting reasonably, and we all know what the standard of care is, and the standard of care changes, remember, if I'm designing a house in the Midwest, it's different than a nuclear power plant on the East Coast. Those are different standard of care. But if you're acting reasonably and predictable behavior within that standard of care, then you're okay. That's what tort law says. We've got to make sure we act within that. And finally, it's this reallocate risk or loss to or injury. You know, when you're a contract, we know, hey, you were supposed to do this, you didn't do that, I had expectation damages, I expected you to do this for X dollars, it cost me X plus Y, you owe me the Y. That's contract, really simple, basic. You don't have those deals set up between you and the walking public. So the walking public has to say, oh, well, my losses are I had to have a cast, and I'm an electrician, so I couldn't work, so I have loss of income, I have pain and suffering, I have my medical bills, whatever else comes, and then you pass those along to the jury, and then the jury see how egregious it is, and they award you hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, whatever the case may be. So that's the purpose of tort law. Really simple. It's similar to contracts, but a little different in the concept of behavior versus the expectation of predicting future in the contract is what's within the four corners of the agreement. Types of torts. Now, this is what I said. This is where it's going to look a lot like criminal law as opposed to in the contract. The duties and obligations in the contract are written in the contract. But torts, you have negligent and you have intentional torts. Intentional torts have a much higher, you can get a higher recovery from them. Sometimes in intentional tort, you get what's called treble damages, where you get three times the damage. And we'll talk about those. And intentional torts also can both civil and criminal. So someone gets someone is attacked and assaulted because we have their battery and assault. So assault and battery. So there's a criminal claim against that individual, and that individual goes to jail because they assaulted me and they committed battery. I can also bring a claim against that individual in civil as a tort. Not only do you have to go to jail, but you owe me money. Now, it doesn't happen as commonly that you sue the criminal that goes against you because a lot of times they don't have the money. A lot of times they're in a situation that you don't have anything to recover. But there are plenty of people, like there was a huge Ponzi scheme by a guy named Bernie Madoff. It was just back 15, 20 years ago. He committed crimes, went to jail. They sued him and then ultimately the estate civilly. When Enron was, that was again a long, long time ago, but when Enron had the issue, they said the company, because companies can be treated as individuals, committed a crime and they were fined, penalties, and then there were civil cases against them. And the other biggest one, it's been many, many, many years, but probably the one that made the biggest headlines of all is O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson was tried criminally and found not guilty. So a jury of his peers said the prosecution has not proved this crime beyond a preponderance of a doubt. Beyond a reasonable doubt, because that's the criminal standard. But the family sued him individually in a civil case, and they won millions of dollars because it was preponderance of the doubt. So both a crime and a civil thing, both on an intentional tort, and the intentional tort was murder. So they, or loss of life or what have you. So that's what, they can be the same thing, both criminal and civil. So we have battery. Battery is actually striking, the physical striking. A lot of you hear like, assault and battery. Well, battery, you must actually physically hit them. There's a physical touching. Assault is putting the person in fear of imminent and harmful contact. So you threaten them. You can assault someone verbally, too. You can be bullying. That would fall under an assault. You can charge at someone but not touch them. Those are considered assaults. That's different. And then assault and battery is just two crimes that are on top of each other. They also are two torts. Trespass is an intentional tort. If you walk onto someone's property illegally, that's considered trespass, and that's intentional. Now, there could be trespass that's unintentional, and then there's a different way to look at it. But if you know that you're going on there illegally, it could be both a crime and it could be a civil claim against that. Conversion. Conversion is the civil way of saying stealing. So when you take somebody's property or you take somebody's money or whatever, you're stealing from them. It's conversion. It's also destroying other personal property. And then the last couple down here, false imprisonment. False imprisonment could also be kidnapping as far as the look at the crime versus the tort. Intentional infliction of emotional stress, that's the physical abusive, you know, type situation that you are over a period of time, it would also fall into bullying or something like that. And then defamation and libel, when you actually say something about someone that's not true to defame them. Libel has to do with whether it's a public party or whatever. So defamation and libel are all considered torts, and they're all considered intentional torts. You've done this on purpose. Yeah. So, real property is a legal term. So there's personal property, your iPhone, your car, your hat. That's what you own personally. Real property is called land. That's what real property is under the law. It's a legal term, real property. So when you step into someone's house and you're not allowed, when you go onto their land and things like that, that's what real property is. So that's why it's a legal term of art as opposed to just real versus fake. And there's also intellectual property. Intellectual property is if you own a copyright, a patent, or a trademark. And they call it intellectual property is while you write down the description of what the patent is, or we all know the Nike Swish is a trademark, you can't hold that. It's not personal, and it's not property and land, so it's up in your head. That's we all understand, we all know what the Nike Swish looks like, but somebody owns it, but what do you own? And so that's why it's called intellectual property. It's just like what exists in your brain, even though it's written down on paper and there's drawings of it and everything else. So, because every time the Nike Swish appears, they should be getting paid for that. Does that make sense? Okay. Negligence. So we've been talking a lot about negligence. So let's just give this is like what's the breach of contract. What is actually negligence here? So it's causing a loss or injury by failing to act in accordance with the acceptable levels of care and caution. We're all supposed to act like nice, civil human beings. And so if you go outside of that, you're considered negligent. And when you get to a professional, as an architect or a lawyer or accountants or doctors, there's a different standard of what you do. So different standards for different people and professions. I, as a lawyer, have a standard of care that I'm supposed to follow. Now, interestingly enough, in addition to that I'm supposed to act like a good lawyer, there are also in the law model rules. And Illinois has model rules, and then there's national model rules that I have to follow. Like, I must zealously represent my client. And there's these various things. And so those are guidelines for when I start doing things. If I fail to perform in the level of care and caution, they can look to that. Now, interestingly enough, because my undergraduate degree is in architecture and I've been practicing construction law, I'm going to be held to a different standard of care in performing on a construction law case than a tax lawyer. Both of us have these minimal levels of standard of care, but when they go to trial, they're going to also say, look at all the stuff he knew. And oh, by the way, he was an architect, and they're going to use that to level me up and make sure that I've been held to a higher standard. And they, the client that's suing me, the one that hired me and now is suing me, hired me for that reason. I went to him because he was an expert. Same thing's going to happen with you guys somewhere along down your career. You may become an expert in hospitals. You may become an expert in high-end residential, whatever it might be. And so if you are being hired for that specialty design area, then when you go and if there's a problem, and I hope nobody in this class ever is in a lawsuit. I hope I get never a call from any of you guys other than help me with a contract as opposed to help me with a lawsuit. And knock on wood, not one of my students in the last 15 years has ever called me for being in trouble. So that's good. Maybe they've learned a little bit from the class, or maybe they're just really good architects. Doesn't matter. You're going to be held to whatever that specialty that you may have created or developed over the years in that standard of care and what's considered acceptable level of care and caution. It's society driven in many respects, negligence. It's like, because remember, in this world, in negligence, you owe it to society. So society drives what's considered acceptable. And what's acceptable today wasn't acceptable 20 years ago, or maybe even 50 years ago. So it moves and changes. The law is living and breathing, and the concept of negligence changes over that year. Case law oftentimes has helped to establish that standard of care. If you have a problem that happens over and over and over, the case law kind of defines what is expected by society. For the same reason why, when I told you the story on the contract side, that the guy that was the sole proprietor that entered into a contract, but he wasn't licensed, the law said you can't practice under the state and your contract is void because your company doesn't exist in our eyes. That's a law that's established there, and the case law created that. The case law defined that based on statutes, but it was defining that says your contract is void because your business isn't licensed. Case law also establishes increased parameters for torts, what's considered acceptable behavior. And then finally, there's often a question of whether the negligence is left to the trier of fact, which may be a judge or jury. So the trier of fact, and I say this only because I loved it when he said it when I was, it was like the first or second day of law school. And here I am, I knew nothing about the law. I went to law school because I told you that story when I was 13. I wanted to become a lawyer, and then people argued and everything. But I didn't take any pre-law classes. There were no lawyers in my family. I knew nothing about being a lawyer. And the first week of class, we had this professor, Professor Coffin, brilliant, brilliant individual. His undergraduate and his master's was in children's education. He loved to teach, and he learned about teaching, and he specialized in K through 6. So he was really good at breaking stuff down to like the simplest basic facts. And then he went to law school, went to Michigan, and graduated top of his class because he's freaking smart. And I remember when he talked about it, we were talking about the concept of our jury system and everything else, and he used to call them, for fun, the 12 royal cantaloupes. Because the people that sit in the jury, I mean, they talk about the jury, the peer, and everything else, but it's, you don't know who's going to be sitting in the room when you're doing voir dire, and you get all the people that ultimately sit in the box. So it's not actually the jury of your peers, it's 12 people, but we always call them the 12 royal cantaloupes. That's what we talk about here. Those are the people that are going to be looking at you saying, oh, I hear the arguments by the two lawyers, I hear what they say the standard of care is, I hear what the expert says the standard of care is, and I know my feelings of what I grew up in, how I was supposed to act. And maybe this person sitting next to them acted differently growing up. So we all bring in our own experiences, our life experiences, and the jury together, which is probably the best part of our system, is they sit down and they figure out in the jury room what was the standard of care, what was negligent, did this person cross the line by 51%? And so you're never sure. The prior fact. And that's where the lawyers come in, and the ones that maybe are more impassioned to deliver this message better can get you out of a claim that you've committed negligence, depending on how the experts are and everything else. And that's why cases go to trial. As opposed to way back when, before our Constitution and everything else, the king was, or the emperor, if you go right back to Rome, was thumbs up, thumbs down. That was the only person that established whether you did right or wrong. Now we have a different system, which is great. I only said the 12 royal cantaloupes because it made me smile when I heard it many years ago. But the jury system is wonderful, and they do allow that trier of facts, because they're listening to the facts, to see what the standard of care is. I mentioned here the trier of law. The judge is always the trier of law because they're going to interpret the law, and they're going to say, no, evidence can't come in, or the law must make you decide this way. But the jury is the one that listens to the facts. And sometimes in what's called a bench trial, the judge is the only person hearing there's no jury. So there's a bench and a jury trial, two different kinds. If it's a bench trial, the judge is both the trier of fact and the trier of law. If it's a jury trial, the jury is only the trier of fact. So, any questions on that? Okay. Situations when negligence is automatically found. Sometimes, your actions who may have been defined by statute or otherwise, that if you do this, it is considered negligence no matter what. So if the violation of a law or a valid regulation is considered to be automatically negligent. So the interesting thing about the O.J. Simpson trial was he was found not guilty of murder. So he did not violate the law, so the civil trial had to prove that he committed the murder. But it was only by a preponderance of the evidence as opposed to by beyond a reasonable doubt. But if you are considered, let's say you kidnap someone, you are then automatically determined on a tort side that you had false imprisonment. And so that requirement to prove that level of negligence is not in the trial. You submit it as, this is an evidentiary standard. We know that this person who has committed the crime, we know that this person has the negligence, and then the rest of the case only becomes about damages. So, and it's to make sure you don't have two different verdicts and two different issues. Now, like I said, you may have sometimes, and the reason why it's so famous is because normally, if you were found innocent of a crime, you're not going to bring a lawsuit against them for civil claims, because they're going to say, look, a jury of my peers found me innocent. That was one of the biggest defenses that O.J. had. But the family that brought the claim, I'm blanking on the names right now, I apologize, they thought that they had enough evidence by preponderance. So you can have something, but most of the time, the reason why is you don't want to have the opposite. You don't want to have someone that's been convicted of kidnapping and then be found not guilty of false imprisonment. You can't, not liable, because in civil cases it's liability, in criminal cases it's guilty. And again, it's relevant to the court of law. They have to take judicial notice that if there was a crime committed and they were convicted of crime, the court will take judicial notice that negligence is automatically established. And so the rest of it has to be damages and your injury, showing what your injury, what your damages are. Now, negligence acts of an agent, and we covered this earlier in agency, is automatically tied to the principal. And you remember that from our class a couple weeks ago. So if an agent acts negligently toward the third party in the scope of the authority, that negligence is automatically attributed to the principal. So the principal there will have automatic negligence against them. You still have to prove it against the agent, but the agent is not going to be the one being sued because the agent is only speaking on behalf of the principal. So, and it can be, it's either straight agency or even apparent agency. So if you say if we're on a construction site and the owner says to the contractor, my owner's rep, Sarah, she's the one that's going to be taking care of things on the project site. She's going to be going through the schedules and the budget and overseeing the money and everything else. And that's the person that I want you to talk to in the project. If the owner says that, and then Sarah, in the course of her work as an owner's rep, says, you know, I don't like the way you installed that bookcase. We need to have it ripped out and reinstalled. And the owner pays for that and it becomes normal actions. Then that becomes apparent authority. The contractor says, it is apparent by how you are treating Sarah, owner, that she is your agent in everything. And so if something goes wrong, even though it was Sarah, and I don't know whether you gave her the authority or not, the apparent agency means you are liable and you need to pay me for that. So apparent agency and regular agency always are tied, if there's negligence, always is tied to the principal. Okay? It's out of the way so I don't hurt myself. Okay, elements. This is similar to end of contract. Duty, breach of duty, causation, and damages. So duty. Existence of a standard of care or duty of care owed to others. And that's the common law standard. That's you owe to society. There's no contract saying what the standard of care is. It's what's owed as you, whether you're an architect, whether you're an individual walking on the street, whether you're a doctor, whether you're a circus performer, whatever it is, you're going to have a standard of care attributable to you. And it's because it's what society says. Breach. You breached that standard of care. You failed to act what is considered reasonable. You were negligent. Causation. There needs to be a causal link between the breach of the specific consequences, the injury, and this is also sometimes referred to as the proximate cause. So let me give you an example. I'm an architect, and I'm designing a building for you, And it turns out that the HVAC system isn't running properly. And that causes it's too cold and too hot and you're having problems with that. And maybe there's even mold buildup and all this other stuff because of the way I designed the HVAC system. It also turns out that the electrical system has some problems, like this one room where every time you plug in the vacuum cleaner, it shorts out the house. I can't sue the architect if the electrical system was designed properly and it just happens that the electrician installed it incorrectly. But if the electrical system was designed properly, I can't sue and say, you breached your contract on the HVAC system and that caused me to have my vacuum cleaner blow out. There needs to be a connection, a causal connection between the action or the omission, the negligent action or omission, and the injury. Another example that we take it out of the architecture, and this happens a lot of times. In fact, I had a good friend of mine that had one of these cases about 2 years ago. There was an individual that came to the end of the street, or to the end of a road, and it was crossing the street. The individual stepped out to go into the crosswalk to cross the street. The individual got hit by a car and was badly injured. My friend represented the individual that was injured. He's a plaintiff's lawyer. The driver of the car said the light was green for him, and that the individual stepped out into the crosswalk, stating that the light was red and didn't take a look because there was the person with the red and not saying, said, don't walk. It was a don't walk symbol. The case came down to, because the individual was hurt, that said, it was still flashing when I went out into the street. So there had to be proof that the individual and the jury had to listen to the facts of the case. Because also brought in was the speed of the driver and the weather of the day, where the sunlight is. Lots of things come into these cases that you don't think about, but people, defendants and everything, it was blinding, it was this, they'll bring in a whole bunch of other stuff. And it came down to the question of, were the facts sufficient to show that the individual was able to walk out without being hit? And was the striking of that person, because we all know that the person got struck, and we all know the person got who hit him and who got injured. So there was not a question of duty. The duty is owed that they must drive safely, and the duty by the individual is they must not walk out into the street when they can't. So the duty was established for both sides. The injury was established because he broke his legs and his hip. And there was damages because there was medical bills and pain and suffering and all that other stuff. So we had three of the elements, because the last one has damage. We had duty, we had breach of duty, because somebody breached, somebody stepped out, or somebody was driving too fast, whatever it might have been. There was a breach, but we didn't know. And there was the damages. So it came down to this question of who breached, and was that breach the actual proximate cause of the injury? If I walk out into the street and I get hit, I know I'm being hit, but if I shouldn't have walked out in the street, there is no causal connection because the other person both didn't breach that and didn't commit a tort because they were driving normally. So you have to have that proximate cause, that connection between them. And there's lots of other examples that you'll find in where people will try to separate and split things out. Sometimes there can be a space in time. I did something wrong here, and a week later, there was an injury that happened. If there's enough space between what you did wrong and something happened, is that a question? I'll give you an example of that. This was also very early in my career. I was working for a plaintiff's law firm for summer job, and there was it was out in the countryside. It was a telephone pole, and it went across the road. Well, there was a telephone pole, electric wire, or whatever. This is a tragic case. And a truck ran into that pole late at night. I don't know if the driver fell asleep or whatever. Ran into the pole, and as a result, it didn't break down, but the pole was bent, and it came down. And as a result of that, the wire came down. About 2 weeks later, winds and everything else, the wire kept going down and down and down. But everybody knew about it. And it was late at night, and there was a family driving, and it came down far enough, and it literally sheared off the top of the car, and the two parents were killed, and the child in the back seat, because he was shorter, did not. So my friend represented the child. And the claim was against both the company that had the wires, electrical company or whoever it was, and the company that had the truck drive into the pole. And the company that had the truck drive into the pole said, look, we hit that 3 weeks before the injury happened, and it should have been the electrical company, because we don't fix poles and everything else. It should have been the electrical company. So they are the ones, and the proximate cause is not us. Sure, we had a duty to drive carefully. Sure, we breached the duty because we hit the pole. But the causation, it's not caused by us, because when we hit it, it wasn't that low, and it came low over time. Now, the jury ended up coming back in favor of my friend's client, the young son, against both companies. But that was their argument, that was enough causal separation in time, and other things should have happened. Weather changed it, the electrical company was made aware of it, didn't get out there, blah, blah, blah. They said there was no causal connection between mine and the other. The jury said otherwise, but that's the jury hearing the facts. But you can have a time that separates between the two. Okay, I'm going to show you a really, really old video, but it's from my youth. And this is about a tort case.
On the one hand, Mr. Douglas made my work that he looked very carefully before he pulled his car out. On the other hand, Mr. Douglas was definitely the same. This leads to court, the general decision, the parallel testimony of both of them.
So, I don't know if you guys know, that's the Brady Bunch from 100 years ago, the original Brady Bunch. And what they're talking about there in that one is that took one of the elements of the torts went away. There was no injury. So Miss Brady was in a parking lot. She came out and she hit the guy's car, and he said he had whiplash. And so he brought the lawsuit, and he came in with a big neck brace and everything else. And there was other stuff that happened in the episode to make people think that the neck brace was fake and stuff. So Mrs. Brady had a duty to drive properly. She breached the duty because she hit the car. And so there was damages that he incurred for that. But he was suing for the big dollars because he had this neck injury. And so there was that injury, and he was then claiming damages. Obviously, our brilliant architects, Mr. Brady, Mike Brady, the most famous TV architect ever, drops the briefcase, turns his neck, and says there is no injury. So the four elements, duty, breach of duty, injury, or crossing, duty, breach of duty, causation to the proximate cause of the injury, that injury didn't exist. And so there was no damages to recover. So just a fun little video on. There's not a lot of tort videos out there, so I still use Brady Bunch from 100 years ago. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the details so we can go into these four elements. Duty. It's the standard of care in general. It's a legal duty to act as an ordinary, prudent, and reasonable person. It's applicable to everyone, because we're talking about society and torts as opposed to contracts and torts just between the parties to the contract. During the contract. Different standards for different people in different professions. We've talked about it a bunch of times. Architect has a standard. Doctor has a standard. Individual walking down the street has a different standard than them. People with mental and physical handicaps are still required to act in accordance with the standard of care in which a reasonable person who is not handicapped would observe. Just because you are in a wheelchair or you are in crutches or what have you doesn't mean that you can act differently than a person that doesn't have those handicaps. Now, the mental question as far as that can come into play a little bit more. And I will say this, that society is much more has much more knowledge and much more tolerance of mental health issues now, and so that someone who has acted outside and maybe gone beyond and maybe committed a tort, depending on what the situation is, may not be held to the exact same standard of care, but the person is still injured that may have been receiving the whatever the crime may, or not the crime, but the tort may be. So it's not as clear, but certainly just because you're in a physical handicap doesn't mean you don't have to conform to the standard of care. But the reality is again, this purpose here is the society can rely on people adhering to certain minimal levels. We all have to be on the same page. When you're walking down the street and you're on a crowded sidewalk on Michigan Avenue during Christmas, everybody's walking around, or whether it's Christmas or the holidays or anything else, but it's really busy on Michigan Avenue, you shouldn't have people bumping into you just because they feel like they own that part of the road. That happens. Or even people driving, road rage. My son just got his license this year, and I swear to God, he has been in, not himself, thank God, but he has been the victim of more road rage accidents in his first 6 months of driving, the people like coming after him and stuff, than I've had probably the last 20 years. Like one time he was coming home from football practice, and he accelerated a little bit to get through a light because it was yellow and he wanted to get through. And he got up behind this guy, and he was just driving normally. And the guy started brake tapping him. So Liam backed off, and then the road went from 1 to 2. And so the next light came up, and so Liam went ahead of him because he was like, I don't want to be dealing with that. The guy accelerated around him, slammed on the brakes right in the middle of the street, got out of the car, and started marching at my son, screaming at him, and then Liam just drove around him like he was freaking out. And then the guy rolled down his window, and he had like his 7-year-old son, and he was screaming at my son. So that's not acting as reasonable standard of care. So you're supposed to act to a certain minimal level, but it happens. So I was like, holy cow, that never happened to me. But I'm not saying there was a tort committed, but there could be an argument that if there was an accident that happened as a result of the way this guy's acting, that his actions, starting and stopping, brake tapping my son, stopping in the middle of the street and everything else, was outside of the standard of care, and he would have been the person, if I was the one telling the story, that the cop would have written a ticket for, and there would have been a crime, and then that would have been considered absolute negligence. And if there was an injury, maybe some other person got hit, it wasn't my son, they could say he was convicted of this crime, and now we have automatic negligence, and now we just recover for the damages. So that's how that could work in a real-life situation. People with greater than average levels of ability or skill of care are held to a higher standard of care that's possessed by a reasonable person with that level of skill, of ability or skill. And that's like, again, if I'm going to be hired as a construction lawyer and have an architectural background, I'm probably going to be held higher to a higher standard in the construction law case than if they hire just your normal general practitioner or tax attorney or what have you. So there's a level of skill that they look into and they take that into consideration. And that's, you know, you are using the benefit of your skills in society to make money, to do whatever it might be, and so the society then relies on you. There's a reliance by the people out there that says you're the expert in this field, so therefore I'm holding you to a higher standard of care. Question? Who are the people with high ability of skills? That's a really good question, and my favorite two words, it depends. So you can say for sure that people that are professions, which we have up there, that's somebody with a higher standard skill of care. But you may have, within that profession, brain surgeons are going to have more than your general practitioner. So within any profession, they also have a higher level of skills. But it can happen with normal people, like somebody that is a craftsman or a tradesman. So I have a person that is just a rough carpenter in the industry, in the construction industry, or have someone that is a finished carpenter and that does really the fine detail work and everything else. Those are two levels of skill. And so if the person that's a rough carpenter who frames the house and puts up all the framing, if they're hired then to do the really detailed fine work of the molding and everything else and it's not as good, you can make the argument that they didn't have that level of standard and skill, and you probably shouldn't hire them. You should have hired a finished carpenter. So it depends on what your skills, and you learn those skills as an individual over your years in whatever business you might do. And so that's what would be taken into account. What will happen is the plaintiff's lawyer, the injured party's lawyer, will tell the jury, oh, Mike has done this, this, and this. You should take that into consideration because he's holding himself out to be skilled in these areas. And my client relied on Mike's skills in these areas. You need to take that into consideration when you're looking at whether he acted reasonably and within the standard of care. Does that help answer your question? Okay. The reasonableness of a person's action is a matter of proof. And that's usually determined by the jury, that trier of facts. You have to prove that they have those skills. So a judge or jury or judge, trier of the fact, on this instance, determines how the ordinary reasonable person should behave and if the defendant lived up to that standard of care. Now I use the word here, ordinary reasonable person, because if you remember when we talked a couple weeks ago, we talked about in paragraph 2.2 of the B101, that's the standard of care. It's the ordinary architect. So you are not, if you're hired, the basic contract as an architect, the standard of care defines you as an ordinary architect. So you're held to a higher standard than the average Joe or Jane walking down the street because they're not architects. But you're not the super architect. You are an ordinary architect. And if that term isn't changed in the contract, whether you are the person that's hired at a normal architecture firm or Helmut Jahn, is still considered an ordinary architect. Now, if I'm the owner and got screwed by the designs of Helmut Jahn's firm, I'm going to argue that everybody knows Helmut Jahn was this, you know, great, amazing architect, and so therefore we expected more, even though it's ordinary. It's the ordinary Helmut Jahn type architect, star architect, whatever you want to call them. But you have a problem with that because the contract just says ordinary. And that's what you have in a normal tort. So the jury, and or the judge, if they're doing the trial fact, they're the ones that determine what's ordinary. And so to your question about what's considered skill, that's ultimately determined by the jury. Now, you proofs, the attorney says, remember I was talking about it, the attorney's going to say, Mike promised he could do this, this, and this. And that attorney is telling the jury that so they will think that Mike's ordinary actions include those three things. But they may not buy it because I may have my lawyers say, we never talked about that. And then the jury has to balance who they believe in the questions of the trier of fact. They are the ones that are balancing the facts. So.
But
yes.
Yeah. Of course, the owner shouldn't have
That's a great question. So if you guys in here in the back, so let's say that the carpenter does the work, but the owner likes this carpenter and says, I'm going to have you do my painting, and the painting is a crappy job. The owner should have done something. Their duty, their reasonable acting, should have hired a painter. But her point is that, well, what about the carpenter? The carpenter knew they were a carpenter, not a painter. Shouldn't that play into the consideration? And the answer is yes. And that's going to be the two sides arguing. There's going to be the owner's attorney saying, this guy never told us he'd never done painting. And yeah, I know she hired a carpenter, but they had a really good relationship, and he never said anything. So when I asked him if he wanted, when my client asked him if he was going to do the painting job, he said, yes, I'm happy to do it. I'll do a good job. And so he owed a duty to tell me he had never did painting. And the carpenter's going to say, hey, she knew I was a carpenter. She should have talked to some other painters. And they're both going to tell that story. And as the sentence says, the judge or jury determines how the ordinary, reasonable person should behave. Is it the responsibility of the owner to do her homework? Is it the responsibility of the carpenter to tell you, I've never painted? And whose responsibility is more? And that's going to be part of what the lawyer is going to try to pitch, and which lawyer is better at telling that story. That's where the art of being a lawyer comes in, is who tells that story better, because the cases go to trial all the way to the judge and jury in less than 5% of all litigation. Less than 5%. And the reason why it goes to trial is because it's such a razor-thin wire as to whether someone did wrong or right on either side. And so it becomes how you present the proofs and how you tell the story. Now, sometimes there, in that 5%, there's like, I'm not going to settle for principle, or I'm not going to do this. There is some of those things that come into. I've represented clients where they have been, like I represented a manufacturing company, and they were accused of fraud. They were going to go to trial no matter what, because if there was a settlement, and it got out into the industry that they settled where they were accused of defrauding people, that would hurt their business. And they were like, we are absolutely not going to put ourselves at risk of having someone here that we paid money, even though we didn't commit fraud, but we paid money for a fraud claim. So we went to trial, we won, and then they could say we didn't commit fraud because the jury said we didn't commit fraud. So there are times you'll go to that, but most of the time you go to jury, you go to trial, because you got to have someone else figure out that razor thin wire. Okay, now the jurors, may not be aware of the appropriate standard of care. I would say the jurors almost never know what the appropriate standard of care is, unless you've been on a jury before, or you took a pre-law class or anything else, or you were one of my students. So, the jury needs to be educated on what the applicable standard of care is. That's part of my job. My job is to hire the expert that says what, if I'm representing the homeowner, what a homeowner should normally do. Or if I'm representing the architect, what the architect should normally do. So I'm going to hire an expert architect. I'm going to hire the person that is considered highly skilled in the field, and I'm going to establish them through a series of questions of my expert witness. Ms. Smith, what have you done? What articles have you written? Where have you testified? I establish her as an expert, and then the jury looks at this person and says they know what they're talking about, and then has to take that into consideration. You had a question over here.
Yeah.
You sure do. You sure do pay experts. Experts get paid very good. I'll tell you this, like if you're in the medical profession, what's called an IME, or is it IME? Trying to remember what the anyway, if you were a doctor, if you were in the medical, if you were doing personal injury with a doctor, the doctors get paid somewhere between, like on a normal case, if they have to go in for a deposition, and depositions anywhere between 3 and 5 or 6 hours, doctors get paid anywhere between $1,000 and $2,000 an hour. Yeah. So if you're an architect, like the architects that I use at experts, they range anywhere from 200 to about 600. Depending on who they are, what their reputation in the field is, and everything else. Extra witnesses are not cheap, but they are necessary because they are considered. And that's when you hear this world, the concept of the battle of the experts. So both sides are going to hire experts. And then who is the better expert? Who's getting paid more? And then the judge, jury, or if it's an arbitration, the panel, has to. They all know that they're getting paid. Because here's what's going to happen. I'm going to put my expert up there, and I'm going to be like, Ms. Jones, tell me about what you wrote, and what you did this, and what you did that. And then I'll, depending if I'm in federal court, you actually have to offer to the judge, you have to say, I am now presenting Ms. Jones as an expert witness, and there's a standard, it's called the Daubert standard, and there's all these other things, it's separate hearings. But for purposes, I present this person as an individual, as an expert, then I go through all the questions. What did my client do right? What did they do wrong? Blah, 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 blah. My 2 hours of direct examination of my expert goes in flawlessly. It looks like my client's completely innocent and the other non-liable, the other side's completely liable, and I put that down. And then the defense comes up, and they're like, Ms. Jones, you're being paid for here, aren't you? Yes. What's your rate? $350 an hour. So how many hours have you worked on this case? And they'll have a copy of all the bills. And they say, let me just go through this. And your bills are this and this. I mean, some lawyers will start out the cross-examination of an expert just establishing that they're a paid gun. And then they'll go into the facts and everything else. Now, the risk of that is later on in their case, they're going to put their own expert up, and I'm going to flip the coin. I'm going to be Mr. Smith. How much are you getting paid for it? So we all know what happens at the end of the day, and so you run a risk, and maybe if you know there's a huge disparity between the $2,000 an hour doctor and the $500 an hour doctor, maybe it's beneficial for you, or depending on how the case comes in. But yes, they get paid, and yes, it's relevant, and yes, the jury can find that information out. So, so I have here, we talked a little bit about standard care is offered to status by using proof from an expert witness who is a subject matter expert. I mean, if I'm having a civil engineering issue, I'm not going to be bringing in a structural engineer. They want to be an expert in that discipline. So I had a case where we had an expert that was an insurance adjuster for damages on the house. There was all these construction defects. And they brought in an insurance adjuster, and he was the guy that would come in if you had leaks in your house in the winter, or if there was fire damage, and he would walk in, and he would look and say, okay, there's some bad drywall, it's going to cost this much money to fix this drywall, and there's this bad, you got to fix the skylight, and maybe this window's got to replace, and he's got this computer program, and he plugs all these damages in, and he writes you a check. That's what he does, and he looks at things, he says, but he's not an architect, he's not an engineer, he's never been trained in that, he doesn't go out to bid with contractors, he has these algorithms or these charts that he plugs in, how much a window is, how much a door is, how much a skylight is, and everything else, and he was the expert on talking about the damages that my client had. My expert was a contractor that did this work, that specially did, and that looked at the problem and said, here's what's wrong with the construction. And then I had a damage expert that said, I looked at what the contractor said, and I priced it out. And then I had other contractors that backed up his numbers, because he went out to other contractors. I went and did this to three different contractors. And so there you're going to have two experts, and we're waiting to hear on this one case which expert came across as more believable. But that sometimes you can have that, where one expert may not be as specialized in the industry, in the field, and you will highlight that to the judge or jury so they don't give them as much credit. But that's who establishes the standard of care if the jury doesn't know it. More often than not, it's going to be an expert. Questions on that? The reasonableness of the person's action is a matter of proof. Oh, this is still the same thing. This is another example of it. Sometimes the plaintiff can avoid proving which defendants were negligent through the doctrine of, this is Latin, res ipsa loquitur, and says the thing speaks for itself. So if you ran a red light and it's caught on tape, and there, you know, one of the red light cameras and everything else, that speaks for itself that their action was negligent. Because we already know it's a crime, number one, but we actually see what happened. So the plaintiff still needs, in a normal case, the plaintiff has to prove all elements of the negligence, but not with res ipsa loquitur. If you have that just by the fact of what you did was considered negligence, committing a crime, you don't have to prove the negligence of the duty, breach of duty in that world, okay? You just have to go through the damages. Duty breach of causation are inferred from the injury that would not have ordinarily occurred without that res ipsa loquitur negligence. That negligence that happened, the injury never would have happened. And so you just skip negligence and you go straight to damages. Now you must show that the defendant, the party that's being claimed or was being negligent, had exclusive control of the situation that caused the injury, and the injury is more likely than not to have been caused by that negligence. So to show, well, they were the one driving down the wheel, driving the car, and they went through the red light, and they were the ones that could have done that, and had they not gone through, it's more likely than not that that's why the person got hit in the street. I know that's a very basic, simple example, but you'll get into that, your lawyer, if you're ever in that situation, will get into that and say, this falls on a res ipsa loquitur, it's the fact that it happened is negligence, and now we have to make this connection, it's more likely than not. And then the plaintiff must show something happened which ordinarily does not happen unless one of the defendants was negligent. Like the example I have on here, if you are have a surgery, and then after the surgery there's all these complications, and they take you in and put an x-ray, and there's an instrument in you, which has happened more than once. I've seen x-rays of that. Do you know there's negligence? Because you're not supposed to leave medical instruments inside somebody's body. So you don't have to prove the negligence. It ordinarily doesn't happen. We don't have that. Or I'm on a construction site and I'm walking there and I forgot my hard hat and a hammer falls on my head. Well, that's not supposed to happen. So negligence occurred if something on a construction site, no matter what. Like if the scaffolding collapsed and someone falls off and gets injured, there was negligence. Is it negligence in the construction of the scaffolding? Was it negligence in the manufacturing of the scaffolding? Was it negligence in the upkeep and maintenance of the scaffolding? Those are the questions, but the fact that I was injured shows negligence occurred. That's RIL. Question over here.
Yes, I just wanted to know, I think you already went over this, but if there's a situation where people are causing negligence, crime, and this is
like
a court, right? The court is
blood against
them. The problem is because of the crime, are they then also criminally discharged after that?
So what happens, so to use the concept that if a crime occurred, to use that in your favor to say, I don't have to prove negligence, the individual must have been found already guilty of the crime. So you would not bring the tort claim to recover for your civil monetary loss until after the individual has been convicted. Because until that individual is convicted, we live in a society that you're innocent until proven guilty, so you're not negligent until found guilty of the crime, if you're going to use this concept of res ipsa loquitur, where the crime shows the negligence. So, and it's not to say that there aren't sometimes cases where they are simultaneously filed. The state is prosecuting. Because, by the way, individuals do not prosecute criminal claims. Only the state, because the state represents the laws, so only a prosecutor prosecutes claims. They're the only people that can make someone guilty of a crime. I mean, the jury says guilty, but charge someone with guilt of a crime. And so sometimes you'll have them simultaneously, but more often than not, if you're going to be filing a tort claim, you don't want to run the risk of that individual getting off for being innocent of the crime, not guilty. Never innocent, it's not guilty, by the way. You don't find a jury where they give a judgment of innocence. They only give a judgment of not guilty. Because what could happen is, if you file at the same time, and you said, I was injured because of what you did to me, and it was a crime, and then that individual's found not guilty, that individual could potentially countersue you and say, you filed a frivolous lawsuit because I was not found not guilty of the crime. I wasn't in that city at the time, and that was my defense, and you didn't believe me, so you didn't cause I didn't cause your injury. And then you're being countersued. And then you don't want to be in that situation. So rarely are you going to file your civil action before or during the time that the criminal case is ongoing. Okay? Okay. Professional standard of care, which we talked about a ton of times, so we're just going to go through this quickly, but it helps you just kind of think this in, because there will be standard of care questions on the exam. It's a professional, the person whose occupation requires sufficient skill and judgment that it would not be fair to require him, I have to put her in there, I apologize, to guarantee the results. Doctor, lawyer, architect, you could put accountant in there as well. Doctors cannot guarantee cures, like an architect cannot guarantee a perfect building. Lawyers can't guarantee acquittals. I never tell my client you're going to win or lose. I say things are stronger here and there. You'll find criminal lawyers, many criminal, and there's a split. There are some criminal lawyers that say, I never, ever, ever ask my client if they actually did it. I don't want to know because I don't want to be put in a situation where I'm making what could be a false representation to the judge or jury. And while I wouldn't necessarily ever say my client didn't do it, what I'm going to argue is they haven't proved beyond a reasonable doubt. There could be a slip-up. So some criminal defense lawyers say, I don't want to ever know. Some criminal lawyers are actually the opposite. They say, I want to know everything. I want to know every single thing, including if they committed the crime, so I can be aware of anything that's going to come up and hurt my client. That's, again, you find yourself potentially more at risk of what you say to the judge or jury, and maybe, because if a lawyer makes a false statement to the court, that's perjury, and then a lawyer can have criminal crimes against them as well. So, and the case can be overturned. Architect does not guarantee its design is 100% perfect. The accountant's not going to guarantee that their audit is right. I actually had a case that was very difficult for me because I never was into accounting or anything else, but it started out as a construction case, and then it morphed and morphed, and all of a sudden I was taking depositions of people from the big four, the big three now. I don't remember which one it was, Price Waterhouse or which one, and I'm like, I'm trying to establish an accountant did malpractice in their audit. I knew the concepts, but it was, but I had to show that they were acting outside of the standard of care. And then the professional standard of care is a level of skill and care which an ordinary person of the profession, would observe under similar circumstances at the same time or in location. So especially in architecture, location is really important. And the type of project. Sometimes you say similar time and location and similar project. Just because you build in the Midwest, and if you're building houses, the next thing you know, you're building a hospital. You are not at the same standard of care as when you're building those houses. So that's what we look at. But it's still the ordinary hospital architect, the ordinary residential architect, whatever it might be. Questions on that? Okay? Typically, and we talked a little bit about this in the earlier slides, expert witnesses are from the same profession, and they're required to prove the standard of care. So that, when I have Ms. Jones on the stand after I establish all of her credentials and offer her to the court as an expert, she must still tell the jury what the standard of care is. It's her job to convince them that the ordinary architect both A, B, C, and D. And the other side, who their expert has established and put in front, says the ordinary architect does X, Y, and Z. And they may not be the same, they may be similar, maybe they do A, B, C, and then X, Y, and Z. There's differences, and they're going to try, the different experts, they're going to try to establish and highlight where they have a difference of opinion on what that standard of care is. And then the second part of that is once you have convinced the jury, the trier fact, of what that standard of care is, then the expert's going to say, and then I looked at Mike Hanahan's architectural services, and he performed within my definition of the standard of care. And the other side's going to say, I looked at Mike Hanahan's services, and he did not perform within my standard of care. And so the jury has to figure out which standard of care do they want to believe, and the jury has to figure out which expert they want to believe as to whether I did my job properly or not. So that's what's going to happen when they convince it. Now, laymen can determine that certain conduct violates appropriate standards, such as a doctor accidentally injecting poison in a patient's vein. You don't need a doctor to say poison into the vein was negligent. So you don't, like, if it turns out that there's a needle mark and they can show that you died of poison, you can have a layman that says, a lay person can say, this is poison. And we have the needle mark and it shows that that's what they did. You don't have to have necessarily a doctor testify to that. You can have, in construction, you can have someone that has built buildings over and over and over and over and over and say the designs were improper. They don't have to be an architect because you can establish that individual with their experience, skill, and knowledge to say what a normal architect is, because I built this wall over and over and over and over. And then they gave me these drawings and they told me to build it in accordance with this wall, and I didn't think it was right. Now that puts the person who actually did the building maybe at risk. But you can have that layperson, someone that's not exactly in the same profession. It's a little harder case to come by. You don't want to necessarily rely on that. Maybe they are secondary witnesses that support. But you can have someone other than just an expert doctor. So the qualification of an expert is to determine whether she or he may opine on the relevant standard of care. And that's that what I said in the beginning. Ms. Jones, tell me your qualifications. Tell me about this, 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 and this. And then you say, Your Honor, I'm offering this individual as an expert in the field. So we had a case years and years ago where it was a wastewater treatment facility, and there was a series of pumps that were installed. So the waste comes in one part, the pump pumps the water through and makes it swirl, and as a result of the centrifugal force, it then causes the different particulates to layer and go into different layers, so the thick on the top and everything else. And then that stuff would be then siphoned off into different elements. Well, the way the structure was built, my client made the pumps. And so the claim was the pump, and my client is dead. Sent four different pumps. They sent one, there was a problem, they sent a second one, they sent four. And every single time, the four different pumps, what ended up happening was there was this vibration, this resonance, and it would tear the pump off the structural supports that it sat in the back where the water was that it was spinning it around and everything else. And so this was a city, and the city was not able to meet its quota of wastewater, and so there was overflows and there was problems, of course, you know, because they need to keep clean water. Well, we brought in an expert that showed that the way the type of steel that was used to support the pump, because we supplied the pump based on what they needed to move the water, the volume of the water, and the type of of installation, but we didn't design how it was installed. We were able to show by a vibration expert that the way they had connected the pump and used the steel was the one that caused the vibrating resonance. So I brought in a vibration expert, in addition to my regular pump guy who talked about his own work. The other side brought in a general engineer that designed wastewater treatment facilities, but he had no experience in vibration. So when we presented that to the judge, we said, this individual can't testify on vibration issues, and vibration became one of the main issues in the case. And so that was very strong in our favor. And that was before we went to trial. We argued it going in, and that helped us ultimately settle the case because they didn't have an expert that was in the relevant standard of care. In fact, he even testified in his deposition he'd never taken a vibration class in his life. Boy, this thing is vibrating and shaking and falling apart. How can you talk about what vibration is? He's like, oh, well, I know, you know, like it was not believable. And so as a result, he testified because he's a pump expert and he's done wastewater treatment facilities, but one of the central issues he wasn't able to speak about. So that helps us quite a bit. Breach. So we're finally gone through the duty. So the duty is the standard of care, what the ordinary people should do in society, all those types of things. Now we got a breach of duty, second element. Defendant's conduct violated his or her own duty. So we've established what your duty is, and now you've breached it. The conduct fell short or falls below that standard of care. So once you establish what they're supposed to do, then somebody testifies or somebody says, you didn't meet that level, whatever it is. And it's a reasonable person test. Could be a reasonable ordinary architect test, it could be a reasonable person walking down the street test, reasonable ordinary doctor test. But the conduct was such that the individual defendant did not act as a reasonable person and would have or should have acted how they would have or should have acted. So, some reasonableness. Or the conduct was a dereliction of the duty as opposed to the individual, imposed on the duty of the individual. Individual slash defendant. So that's who's being sued. So, this duty is imposed on you. Society tells you need to do this, or an architecture, the contract says you've got to conform to the standard of care, so it's been imposed on you, and you failed to do that. You were in dereliction of that duty. If the defendant is an expert or professional, so the defendant is the person being claimed that they committed the negligence, the standard of care that was breached by the defendant is related to what is expected from such an expert or professional. I've said this a bunch of times, so requires a different level of standard. It's the reasonable architect, it's the reasonable engineer. That's what we look at, not the reasonable person. And even if, like for example, let's say that I design a home. I'm not an architect, but I grew up building stuff my whole life and this and that, and I design and build my own home. And I know in Illinois, you don't have to have an architect to design and build your own home. So you do that. You design and build your own home, everything's fine, and then you've lived there a couple of years and you sell it to someone, and then there's a failure in the architectural structural. That's an interesting question. If they sue you because you designed it, can they sue you? Well, there's no contract between you as an architect and that individual, so you can't sue them in tort due to the economic loss rule. But if there's some way that you can somehow show some connection between that and the injury, then the question would come here on this last one, what's it reasonable? Well, they're not an architect, so it's not a reasonable architect. So it's just a layperson. Would a layperson have known this? So there are some weird areas in the law dealing with construction because you can build your own house, but that's why you get something like the economic loss rule that says I can't sue you in tort for design defect. So. But don't worry about the economic loss rule for legalists. Okay, causation. We have to have that connection. Plaintiff must prove the defendant breached the standard of care was the proximate cause of the injury. Proximate cause is both an actual cause and not too distant cause chain. So it can have space in between it. That's what my friend that had the big lawsuit against the trucking company and the electrical company with the poor young boy was able to show that there was a causal connection and the distance in time, even though it was a few weeks, was not too much. The plaintiff doesn't have to show that the defendant's conduct was the only cause of the injury. Clearly in that example, the only cause of the injury that was argued by the trucking company was that the wire came down too low and the electrical company knew about it, and so they should have fixed it. So the only cause was the failure of the electrical company. They were made aware, blah, 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 blah. But you can make the argument that there can be more than one cause. It can be a chain of events, which is what happened in that case. The plaintiff's claim is sufficient if one of the causes results in the injury. So you can have A led to B, led to C, and then C ultimately caused injury if you can make those connections back, which is exactly like I said. The truck ran off the side of the road, it hit the pole went down, the pole, the wire wasn't too low to win a number of days, then the wire came in. So you can bring and you can create that causal connection in the chain. And remember, proximate cause is not the only proximate cause, and more than one person or entity may be liable. Sometimes you're going to have a situation where you have two or three or more people that are liable, but you only go with the only gun after the big dollars. So you have a contractor, you have an architect, you have whatever it might be that did the work bad, poorly, and everything else. But the contractor is a multi-billionaire company or whatever. You're going to gun toward that one. And they're going to say, well, the architect screwed up here and the architect screwed up there. They're like, I don't care. I'm still going after you because you had defective construction. And so there may be some minimizing and stuff. So you, as the plaintiff, have your choices. You go after all of them. You only go after some of them. What may end up happening is in a lawsuit is you may, the plaintiff may only sue the contractor, and then the contractor tries to bring in the other parties and says, it's not my fault, it's your fault. So the test whether is whether or not a cause is proximate is whether the results were reasonably foreseeable. It was foreseeable, the jury determined, that this pole, after the truck hit it, bending down the wires, even though it didn't cause the injury that night, it was reasonably foreseeable that had that condition continued, that this could have happened. And they should have done something themselves more proactively. Because they caused it. They should have been on with the electric company. Have you fixed that? That's the argument that was made. So, courts interpret the requirement of reasonable foreseeability quite broadly. It's really broad. Reasonable foreseeability is this, like, could I really think of it, and does it make sense that I could have thought of it? So that's something that comes into lots of cases. And that, this whole concept of what's reasonably foreseeable, is another reason why we go to trial. Because what I think is reasonably foreseeable, the other side may not, or they may convince themselves it's not, or a man may convince themselves that they are. And so when you are like on that razor-thin wire as to what the parties believe is reasonable and what's foreseeable, you don't agree and you go to trial, as opposed to settling. Causation continues. So we have the but-for test is something else you can think about. So, but for the defendant's negligence, would the plaintiff have suffered the injury, damage, or loss? You know, if they didn't do this thing, and that kind of, it's not quite res ipsa loquitur, it's not quite saying that this is negligence established, but had this not happened, had the plaintiff never, had the defendant not designed this, had the defendant not built this, had the defendant not driven the car they did, would my injury or loss have happened? That's one of the tests you put in front of the jury. And the causal chain may be broken by a superseding or intervening cause of the injury. So you could do something that before would have caused the injury, but there could be a break in that chain. So an act by someone else after the defendant's breach, which is so extraordinary or unforeseeable as to break that causal chain. That's what the trucking company tried to argue. They tried to say, 3 weeks later, they still hadn't fixed the wire. Who would have thought that? I mean, that was the condition they were made aware of, and it's not reasonable for me to have to go out because I'm a trucking company. I'm not an electric company. And so there is a causal break between what my guy did. I agree that he did something wrong and that it started the whole thing off. But there was this break because it's not reasonable that the electrical company didn't fix it. And the jury didn't buy that, but they apportioned the damages quite differently between the trucking company and the electrical company. So, criminal actions or intentional torts of third persons will break a chain because now we have something that happened between X and Y. So let's say it was a crime that they let that wire sit out there, if there was some ordinance or statute or something that said they didn't do that, or if electrical company said, oh, we know about this, but we're just not going to bother to go out there because it's not on a regular run. You could make that argument that that was something that broke the chain. And then unforeseeable acts of God. Let's say that what happened was is the truck hit the pole, the wire came down, and it was still in a safe condition. It was still 40 feet off the ground. The electric company had somebody set up to go out there, and then that night there was a lightning bolt that hit and brought the wire down more, and that's what happened. You could maybe make that argument that that act of God, because it wasn't reasonably foreseeable that it would come down that night, but everybody had been aware of it, broke the chain. So there are different times. They're all fact-specific as to what can break that causal chain. Our last element is damages. Damages intended to compensate the injured party for all the injuries suffered. So we have examples of different types. There's lost wages, I couldn't go to work, cost of repair, replacement of the damage of the property. So like if somebody gets in a car accident with you, even if you're not hurt, there's a tort because they smashed into your car, the damage is to fix your car. Pain and suffering, the guy in the Brady video was trying to say I had really bad neck pain and suffering, and obviously it wasn't too bad because he turned his head. But those are claims that people make, and it can be for all different types of injuries and otherwise. Particularly in personal injury cases, damage can be many millions of dollars. We've all heard about those multi-million dollar vertical words. Interestingly, I used to tell this story way back, I want to say it was in the probably the mid-90s. There was a big case with McDonald's down in Texas, or the case went to trial in Texas, where an older woman got ordered coffee and it was super hot and burned herself, and then there was a huge jury verdict. And I could have sworn that the jury verdict was like $80 or $90 million. And so I always would talk about it in the class. And then I think it was last year or the year before, a woman wrote me. She had been hearing my lectures online, and she's like, "I heard your lectures." She's like, "Let me send you the case. I had the numbers wrong. There was a jury verdict against McDonald's. It was significantly lower, but there was a jury verdict against McDonald's because they were negligent in how hot the coffee was and everything else. But I forgot to pull this. I was going to do that before today's class so I could actually quote it properly. But you can have things like that. And I just remember getting this one like, oh man, I got egg in my face because I've been telling this story for years and I've been telling it wrong. But they were still millions of dollars, and that happens all the time. And people will actually find areas of the country to file their cases in. Like Texas, there's these couple counties in Texas where there are huge jury awards. DuPage County is going to give lower awards than Cook County, but there's a couple cases downstate that they try to file claims in that have giant jury awards in Illinois. I can't remember if it's which county it is, but so they form shop. They try to find an injury in that area or a way to get that area because those areas are known for giving higher dollar value awards. Design defects in major buildings cost hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars repair. That happens with me all the time. There's this concept of called betterment. I will not test you on this, but let me give you an example of what betterment is in really simple terms. You drive a Chevy, the car's totaled. You need money to get a new car. You can't say, "I need money for a Cadillac." You only get money for a Chevy. If you went out and bought a Cadillac to replace that Chevy, you can't say, "I need all that money because I needed a car to drive and the only thing on the lot was the Cadillac, so I bought the Cadillac. So give me the extra money." That's a betterment. You got better than what was this damaged or destroyed. One of the arguments in that pump case that we were saying defense against them is the village came to us and the other designers and contractors and said, "We want you to install." It was the equivalent of a Chevy pumping wastewater treatment system. It was solid. It did good work. It did everything they wanted to do. And their designer that came in designed them a Cadillac. And so they said, "We need all the money for this new system." The pumps were a higher grade and higher value, and from one pump system to a four pump system. So we argued that they got a better system, so why should we have to pay for the betterment? Had they designed to put in something similar to ours, we can understand that, but they don't get the betterment, the extra dollars. So, and be careful of that. That will happen to you guys if you're ever in an action. Somebody will try to get something better from you. And if you feel, if you're in a case and you feel that the other side is getting something more than what you gave them, tell your lawyer, say, "Is that betterment? Are they getting something more? You know, that we went from satin nickel finish on the hinges to a high gloss chrome. You know, is that valued right? Whatever it might be." So, and then for all these things we've been talking about, is all the things the defendant did wrong and caused the injury to the plaintiff. Well, the defendant has some defenses here. Sometimes they can say, "Not just me. You did something wrong. You stepped out in the curb. You shouldn't have. That's one of my defenses." So there's what's called contributory or comparative negligence, when the plaintiff's own negligence is the proximate cause. If it was true in that case that I talked about, that my friend had, if it was true that it really was a don't walk, and the client, his client stepped out and got hit by the car, that is not at the 100% defense to that claim. I was driving, it was a green light, I was doing what I was supposed to do. So it was the proximate cause wasn't my driving. It was their failure to conform to the walk, don't walk sign. So the concept here, we have two things here. We have contributory and comparative. So contributory, and it's the old rule. There's still some states that use contributory negligence, although it's a modified version of it. But it used to be for everywhere. If you were even just 1% contributing to your injury, just 1%, the defendant was found clear and not liable because you contributed to it. So the states, and I have to go back and check to see if they're all still, but they were as of a couple years ago, Alaska, Maryland, North Carolina, Virginia, and D.C., they still follow the contributory negligence rule. There's some modifications to it to give some flexibility and everything else. But the modern clause, what, do you have a question over there? What's the question? Yeah.
And so the cars were incorrect. So
it's a great question. So it's there's this car drive down the road. They're driving legally. Has the green light. The kid darts out, and the car swerves. And did the car hit someone or cause
another parked car?
So there was damage to the parked car, so there was a claim against the party that swerved and hit that. So there is what's called the dart out rule, and I haven't looked at a dart out rule case in a long time. But there is this standard of care, like were they driving? What you'll get into the question is, were they driving too fast? Were they in an area where it could have been reasonably foreseeable that the child would dart out? Is that a defense? Even if they hit the child, could that be that the kid was caused because of the dart out or not? There's nuances around that. As opposed to like if a car who wasn't operating under, you know, there's more obligations because your child may not know things. And so the law looks at that a little differently. I don't know it exactly, but the car, that the parked car that got damages, probably would have sued the driver for sure, or could have sued the driver for sure. And my guess is what would happen because of the way insurance works is the insurance companies would have settled and resolved it as opposed to trying to go through trial and bringing out the child and everything else. But there could be an instance where, let's say what's going on is that there's a party in somebody's house and there's all these kids running around in the neighborhood and there's these parents there, but there's this huge row of trees, these evergreens, so you as the driver going down the road, you can't see that, so you would have no idea. And one of the children from the party darts out, so you swerve, you're doing your best, you hit the parked car. The injured party with the damaged car potentially could sue the parents of the party because they weren't managing their kids properly. There could be a claim there. You had a reasonable duty to keep all the kids in this one spot. So there's lots of ways that someone, depending on what the value of the damages are and those types of things, that you could potentially make a claim out of that. So, the other rule, the Morata rule, which we have in Illinois and most of the other states, is it's called a comparative negligence. Comparative negligence is it says, okay, let's say that I'm injured and I have a leg off. Because of my injury on a construction site, it crushes my leg. It has to be amputated from the knee down. And so it's a leg off case, and so there's a value to that, and you can't work what you did before. And so I'm the plaintiff's attorney, and I go to the jury, and I say, I'm going to ask for $5 million for my plaintiff's pain and suffering and medical bills and so forth and so on, and that's my request to the jury. Turns out, though, that I, the worker, was kind of screwing around and he was doing stuff and he didn't have his fall protection on or whatever it might be. So there was some negligence that the worker had. And so the other side is going to try to argue, the plaintiff is going to say $5 million for my client. The other side is going to say, well, yeah, there was some negligence on my party's side, but they had negligence too, and we need to compare that negligence. And let's say, and you as the jury, and the jury forms will even have that, will ask you to do a percentage split. So let's say that they say that the worker was 20% at fault. Well, then we would award, and we agree the $5 million is the damages. We're only going to award $4 million because 20% of $5 million is $1 million. and the plaintiff was responsible for that. So they apportioned the damages based on the percentage of split. And there's all these different nuances because there's multiple plaintiffs and whether it's over 25% and everything else. But the concept is let's do this equitably between the percentages. However, in a pure comparative state, if you're 51% or higher, it falls back to contributory. So if the jury says the injured party was 51% and the defendant was 49%, injured party gets nothing. That's in a pure comparative. Modified comparatives could say 51, 49, and we're going to give you 49% of the total value of the damages, so you still get paid. So each state is different in how they handle this. For your purposes, just know that there are two concepts. Contributory negligence can happen, and then you get nothing. Comparative negligence happens, and normally it's based on a percentage of split. And yet, other than the contributory negligence, it's about fairness. You're just balancing the scales. That's what we're trying to do. So, and that's why most states have gone to this comparative negligence, because that balancing the scale of 99 and 1% just didn't seem fair. You were only 1% at fault, so the 99% was bad. I mean, that was, not to say that was easy, but a good lawyer could always tack just a little bit on the person that was injured. Question here. How do you quantify the damages? So the damages are quantified by a couple of different ways. You're going to be able to, let's say if it's a worker injury, somebody on a construction site, an engineer, electrician, they're going to have an hourly wage, and so they're going to show that they would have made X dollars while they were injured and recovering, and they didn't get paid that wage because they're being paid on a week-by-week basis, and so there's a really standard calculation of an hourly wage. That's one part of it. Let's say that the worker had the leg off and now he or she can't go up and down a ladder, and so there's a lot of electrical work you have to do on ladders, and so they're limited to what they can do. Maybe they can't even go back to the profession. So then what you do is you get, they're called actuary tables, and you get experts to testify. This individual will be making this much money over these many years. She's 35 years old. She can't ever work again in the electrical industry. That's her profession. She would have worked till at least 55. Here's 20 years of dollars, and so you, and then it goes up by the cost of living, and so there's that calculation. And then you go to the jury and you say, oh, no, by the way, so not only does she lose this money while she's recuperating, and not only she's moved this money by with a job that she can't do that she loves and everything else, but she has to wear a prosthetic, and that causes pain. And she can't run around like she used to do. And there's all these things of the loss of enjoyment of life, some things that she used to do all the time. And so you establish that. And a lot of plaintiff's attorneys will have a video of the day in the life of Miss Smith and show what they did. They'll have like, it'd be amazing how they can put these together. They'll pull your iPhone and show what you used to do with your kids and your family and everything else, and they'll put this together and show a day in her life, and then they'll show now a day in the life. They'll say, this is what she used to do, and this is what her life is now, and every day, and they'll show her putting on the prosthetic and how she can't do this and do that. And then that, they quantify by what they believe, and sometimes experts talk about that quality of life, but that's the number, and that's normally the number that's the big number. And that's the number that you have to sell more, and what the costs are, and everything else. So, and then you would use experts for that, and everything, and that type of thing. Like another one of our friends worked on a case where there was a child that was had issues because of the way the labor went, and so the child was born but had brain defects because of there was not enough oxygen and everything else. And so they had to have X-ray tables for how long this individual would live. And I think the verdict was like $44 million of these costs because somebody would have to take care of them, you know, all the extra things that go through from here to the end. So it's all different types of formulas and damage experts that come into that. So, go ahead. Yeah. Because as a good lawyer, I'm going to convince you that he contributed 1%. The whole percentages and everything else, I'm going to tell you as a juror where I think the percentages are going to fall, and I'm going to have to convince you. That's my job, and I'm going to show facts in the case as it goes along. And the other side's going to say something entirely different, and they're going to tell facts in the case, and then you guys are going to go back in the room and do what our great system does, and you're all going to sit around the table and you're going to talk about it. And there's going to be some people in the room who will be like, they are totally liable, 100%. And they're going to be like, no way, it was like 80-20. And then you figure it out. And that's one of the things you do. And I will tell you this, like, even though I said the 12 royal cantaloupes, most jurors take their job really seriously. And most jurors, my wife has sat on two criminal defense juries, and I won't tell you how they came out, but she was really proud of the work that she did with the people in the room on how it went through. Like, most jurors actually really, well, it's a pain. You can't go to work. You get like $25 a day, or maybe it's up to $40 a day. So it can be a very detriment to you because you're not making money at your own job. But most people take it as this is something that's pretty unique in our country, and they work hard at it. So when they go to those percentages, there's a sheet that the two lawyers give you that say, this is what I think the percentages are, and then the judge gives you a blank piece of paper. And you look at this, and you look at this, and you all talk, and then you fill out the numbers that you want. So, question over here.
Yes. I offered
$100,000 for each. I read 30, but they offered a significant number.
Yeah. $8,000 was supposed to. Yeah. But, to me, that seems kind of low, and I was wondering, like, how.
So if you read what I read about it, was it was $30,000 without giving up any rights of a claim. So it was just, here's 30. It's kind of like if you're bumped off a flight and they give you a voucher for a hotel in the next flight and here's $500. That's what it was. It was without any strings or ties to it. And it was, I think Delta was the airline. I thought that was actually a very good move to say, here's money, you guys went through a really, really awful experience, and here's money, and by the way, if you still want to sue us, you can. It wasn't written like, here's money and you can sue us still. It was, here's money and you are not releasing any of your rights. And then the people, there are going to be people that are going to be claimed. Certainly people got injured. And there are going to be people in their mates. There's probably going to be an attorney that's going to probably call everybody on the flight and say, let's put a class action together and everything else. The problem with it is from my understanding, is there was 70-mile-an-hour wind shears. And so was it the pilot's fault? Was it Mother Nature? We know that the cause of their injuries was the plane flipping upside down. So we have a duty to fly properly. But if a plane that flipped upside down, you would say that as res ipsa loquitur, that they committed negligence. And we have injuries and damages, so we have all those things connected. But we may have this intervening cause. Mother Nature may have caused that. We don't know. And so Delta says, especially for the people that aren't injured, here's $30,000. You can still sue if you want. And maybe they say, I'm taking that. I'm not going to go for a lawyer because I may not win. I got this story to tell me, and I'm going to go pay some bills. So I thought it was actually a good move for them, purely PR. That was because there was 90 people on the flight, or 70 people or something like that. It wasn't a huge dollar figure for them. What, $2 million, I think, if you take the 30 times 70, like $2.1 million? That's cheap compared to a massive series of lawsuits. And it definitely, from the article I read, said there was no release of any rights. Had they released the rights, and lots of companies do that, they will try to pay for you to not bring an action. If you have to release your rights, 30 would be way low, and that would have been a bad move by Delta. Because they would have been saying, I'm trying to pay you off to be quiet. And so, but that's a good question. So, okay. Contribution indemnity. So I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to go a little fast because I'm not going to get into questions on the exam, but you need to understand this for purposes of if there is a lawsuit, because as I talked about it, in America we sue everybody, and I've given examples where sometimes the plaintiff will sue one person and another person will sue somebody else, and then you get into this question of multiple parties, or maybe there's just like the plaintiff, the injured electrician, sues the architect, the contractor, and the owner, and there's all three there, and how you apportion their costs and their percentages. So we have this concept of, there's two concepts that are in the law called indemnity and contribution. We're talking about indemnity first. Here's what you need to understand about indemnity. I'm going to tell what's on the screen and everything else. There's only one thing that I want you to understand about indemnity. indemnity, other than in my knowledge, other than in Pennsylvania, must be agreed to under contract. So it's not automatic. It's not like a tort. It's not owed to everybody in society. I believe in Pennsylvania, indemnity is a societal owed. That's where their law is written, from one of the Philadelphia or Pittsburgh attorneys that I work with. But all the other states, to my knowledge, are the only way you have the obligation to indemnify someone else is if it's contractually bound. So it's in your contract. So it would come as a breach of contract claim. And the term indemnity means I'm architect, you're owner. Going back to Groucho and Harpo Marx, we're the party and the first parties. We're the first parties. Maybe there's a contractor, because I'm architect, you're owner. There's a contractor over here. They're party and the second party. They're all part of that dance. They're all parties of the contract eventually. Indemnity deals with someone who's not in the contract. They are the third uncontracted party. On a construction site, the owner doesn't have a contract with the electrician. The owner doesn't have a contract with somebody walking down the street. They are people that are injured in tort from an action where they have no contractual obligation. And indemnity says, I'm the guy walking down the street and get hurt. The only thing I know about this property is who owns it, because they have a big sign. I'm building this factory for Haribo. I don't know who the architect is. I don't know who the contractor is. I don't know any of this stuff. I sue Haribo only, because they're the people I know. When I was on the project site, I was going to visit, and you know, a bat of candy fell on me, and I got hurt. So I sue Haribo. Turns out that the reason why that bat of candy fell on is because the architect designed it incorrectly. Haribo's like, we just make the stuff. We didn't design the machines. We didn't do this. We didn't do that. And so I have an agreement. Haribo and the architect have an agreement that says, if I, Haribo, am sued by a third party, it always is a third party. If Haribo is sued by a third party and it's caused by the architect, bad design. Architect, you must indemnify me, the owner, indemnify Haribo, which means you must take care of if the person that got hurt, that third party that got crushed by the bat of candy, if they have a $1 million judgment, Haribo doesn't pay it. The architect does. Even if the injured party never sues the architect, even if Haribo doesn't sue the architect, they have an obligation to indemnify Haribo for their negligence. It's a negligence concept, but it has to be through contract. You have to write it in, but it's a negligence concept. So it's a security against loss or damages. You compensate the person for the injury and loss, but it deals with third party claims, not first party. First party are the people in the contract. Third parties are the ones outside in the world that get hurt. But the person who gets hurt files suit against the wrong person, and the wrong person looks at the person who actually caused the problem and says, you must indemnify me. You need to pay for the damages I have to pay the person who got crushed by the candy. That's what you need to know, and that's as high level as you need to know. And trust me, a lot of lawyers don't understand it. There's sometimes where you can argue this is first-party indemnity and blah, 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 blah. Don't even worry about that. But that's the concept. So it's a contractual obligation of one party, the indemnitor, to compensate a loss occurred to the other party, the indemnity, due to the actual indemnity of another party. So the loss, the indemnity, would be Haribo. The contractual obligation, the indemnitor, is architect. Architect indemnifies Haribo. Haribo incurs the loss because they had to pay the third party. Does that make sense? Question over here. I know, it's really confusing. That's why it's not on the exam. But ask me the question anyway.
Yes, okay.
I'm Haribo, I want to build a new factory. I hire you to be the architect. You're going to design me the factory and it's going to work perfect. But not perfect and not guaranteed, it's going to be to the standard of care. Okay? You're like, no, I'm not giving you anything perfect. I'm only a standard of care person. I'm like, okay, I agree to that. So we got that in the contract. And they say, oh, by the way, you need to indemnify me. And you're like, what does that mean? And that means I say to you, if one of your designs fails, is outside of the standard of care, and hurts somebody visiting my factory, Because I don't have a contract with him, you don't have a contract with him, but they sue me because they got hurt. I'm like, I didn't design this. I had nothing to do with it. I just paid you to do the job. You need to indemnify me. That person sues me, gets a judgment, and I got to pay him $1 million. I look to you and say, you're indemnifying me. Give me the million back. Because I have to pay them. The judgment's not against you. The judgment's against me. Because it's my factory. And you designed it. So I'm saying it's your fault. Now, of course, it's never going to be exactly like that because they're also going to say you had an unsafe factory and why'd you have this guy walking around without the helmet on and blah, blah, blah. So it's going to be then this comparative negligence we just talked about and you're going to be paying 80%, I'm going to be paying 20%, and all this other stuff. But the concept of indemnity is you had the obligation to me and you failed, but I was only injured because somebody else sued me. So that's the way the third party works. So everybody got that now? Okay. So, hold harmless clause is saying I hold you harmless, I'm going to identify you, you're going to read this, it'll see that, I hold you harmless and will identify you, that's like the magic language you'll see. What it really is at the end of the day, and that's that whole why I always kind of say I do this and I have the third party way over here, it's a risk shifting. I as the owner have certain risks, like if I'm running a factory, I got to run it the way a reasonable factory owner runs a factory, but I'm not the designer. But I got a factory that's operating by a designer, so I'm going to shift my risk of the design to you, so if somebody outside comes after me, I can shift that. That's all it is this risk-shifting concept of indemnity. It's important, though, because what I want you to understand is, the reason why I raise it, and I don't test you on it, is because unless you have a really unsophisticated owner, you will have to indemnify every single owner in every contract you ever sign. So it's not something that goes away. It's not something you'll never see. Just because I'm not testing you on it doesn't mean you're going to see it. In fact, it's going to be in every single project you ever work on. And if you can get one without it, more power to you. But most of the contracts, I never let an owner go and indemnify without indemnification with the architect. And in fact, this is just a side note, because I'm the owner, and I'm not a designer, because I'll get the same indemnity, by the way, from the contractor too. If you built it wrong and I get sued, you need to indemnify me. So I got it from the design problems or the construction problems. As an owner, because I have the money and I'm just the person paying the checks, I never indemnify backwards. I never do a reciprocal indemnity. I'm like, why should I indemnify you? I don't have anything to do with your design. I don't know what you're doing. You design it right and I'm paying you for it. You indemnify me, and I'm paying for that indemnification. By the way, you're going to build in an additional cost into you. We'll talk about that second semester, or second part of the semester, how you pay for that. You pay for it through insurance, and that insurance will pay for it. So it's not like you're giving it to the owner for free, but it is out there. And the worry is, for architects, not as much with contractors, but the worry for architects is let's say that the injury is a leg off, and it's a $5 million injury. You may only carry $3 million in insurance. I'm still going to look to you for $5 million, and the insurance company is going to write me a check for $3 million, and then you got to couple the extra $2 million. So there are risks to that about it, but so that's why you built it into your pricing and everything else. So again, we'll talk about that later in the semester. Contribution. So that's the second part of this concept here. Contribution is a method by which the defendant brings a third party into trial. Now, third party, not the injured party, a true third party that could have cost to it, to reimburse the defendant for the percentage of that plaintiff's damages, which were really the fault of the third party. So here's what happens in this. Same thing. Guy comes to my factory, terrible. Candy falls on him. Sues me, is terrible. I'm going to sue you, architect, for breach of contract. You designed it improperly. I'm going to also say you need to indemnify me, and I'm going to say you contributed to it. And so what that's going to do is allow the jury, remember I talked about the jury doing a percentage? When that $1 million award comes, and they say it's worth $1 million, that's how much this person has injuries, between medical damages and the pain and suffering and the fear of tiny little bears, whatever they have nightmares over that for the rest of their life, that it's worth $1 million, the jury is going to look to see and who contributed to in contribution claim, and I can actually even bring in somebody that I don't have a lawsuit in, I can bring in maybe the electrician through contribution. It's a different angle, a different act. That's why I'm not going to talk about it in a test. There's always different rules of how you can bring people in, and that it's outside of the economic loss rule, blah, blah, blah. But the whole concept of contribution. So we have indemnity contribution. What you need to know about indemnity is two first parties. Third party sues one of the first parties, and the other first party needs to indemnify them for the loss. That's the risk-shifting thing you need to learn about indemnity. Contribution is the different rules of the law. You can bring more people to the dance, more people to the lawsuit. So there's still the individual here that has the $1 million claim, one person. But to try to get as many people involved that were potentially responsible. So it's not just the architect, it's not just the contractor, but it's the candy supplier, and maybe there's this, and so you have Haribo, you have the architect, you have the contractor, you have the candy supplier, you have the cleaning company that didn't do proper mopping. They're all brought into this claim, and by hook or by crook, there's a contribution action. Who contributed what percentage? And the juries are going to get that verdict form, and each one of those companies is going to have their own lawyer, and they're all going to show what the percentages are, and they're going to break it down as to who contributed to what. So that's what contribution is. It's the mechanics, and there's more law about it, but it's the mechanics by way all the potential negligent parties are brought in and the costs are allocated. Okay, that's all you really need to know about contribution. Talks about in here, like, you know, it's indemnity is the same as contribution, except the third party becomes liable, blah, blah, blah. The owner sues the architect. Keep these notes for sometime in the future when you ever get into an action, but that's what you need to know about contribution. I have two examples, so you can look at them to kind of understand what they say here. Owner plaintiff sues the architect for construction defects based on the architect's negligence. The architect brings the contractor. He doesn't have a claim. The architect doesn't have a contract against the contractor, so he can't sue him in tort because of the economic loss rule. So he sues him in contribution. The architect brings the contractor, who actually built the defective work, into the trial to indemnify the architect of the plaintiff's losses and potentially through contribution. So there are ways to bring parties in that the law has created to get everybody to the dance. Contractual indemnity, any party can make a promise in a contract to indemnify the other party for certain specific consequences. So you can actually narrow. It's not just indemnify you for everything that happens. You narrowly define what I'm indemnifying you for. And sometimes the fight is, oh, that injury, it happened, and there was a loss, but my contract doesn't say I indemnify you for that. So that's where the crafting of how the language goes in. In fact, I'm in a negotiation right now with an architect where we have very divergent opinions of what they need to indemnify. My client's the owner, and they're like, we're not indemnifying you for that because we don't get insurance. And I'm like, I don't care if you don't get insurance. You still did the work. We're paying you huge dollars. This is like a really, really, really high-end residential contractor on the East Coast. And like his fees are, he's really good, but his fees are like through the roof. He's making lots of money from lots of, because all of his clients are multimillionaires or billionaires. I mean, he works with the highest, so he's doing a lot. And I'm like, look, I understand you can't get insurance for it, but I don't care because you still screwed up, so you need to indemnify me for your screw up. So, you know, that's where we're tweaking the language as to what is indemnifying me for. Question?
Are you not operating out of the indemnity or the insurance?
So, the question was, is if you don't carry insurance as an architect, are you operating outside the standard of care? I am not aware of, there could be, but I am not aware of a law that says you must carry insurance. Like in automobiles, you have to carry at least some drivers, you have to have some insurance for driving. But I do not know if there is a law that says architects must carry insurance. I'm confident that that's certainly not law in every single state. So what happens is, and the reason why I know this, is because I represented, actually it was one of my partners this years and years ago when I was associate. And I just joined the firm, and he's like, you got to take care of these two little small cases, Mike. It was downstate Illinois. And the architect didn't carry insurance. And in fact, he specifically didn't carry insurance to protect himself in lawsuits. I was like, how does that work? He designed barns. It was very simple stuff. But because we live in America, you sue everybody. And so what he would do is, and this was an instance, I mean, it was a complex barn, but it was very simple architecture. And you could argue that it was a nuisance suit against him, and I could have fought and shown that this was the reason why there was a failure, wasn't his design, he's done this a million times, and that would have cost this guy $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in legal fees. And then the other side had to win, and then they would have to get money on top of that. So what I did is I called up the other side, and the damages were not that expensive. I mean, ultimately, the cost to litigate would have been more expensive than what the plaintiff was asking for damages. I think it was like $20,000, $30,000 in damages to fix the barn. I called the guy up, and I said, "Hey, my guy has no insurance. I'm offering you $5,000 as a cost of defense to get out of the case." He's like, "He has no insurance?" I'm like, "Yeah." And I go, "So you're barking after an empty well because it's only him and he's got his pencils and desks. He's old school. So you're not going to get anything from him because he's incorporated and his company's licensed. So you're not going to get his car. You're not going to get his house. You're not going to get his boat. Any of that stuff. You're going to get, he rents his office. So you're going to get some computers that are, you know, 10 years old and a couple of whatever." And the guy's like, "I'll take the $5,000. So he did it on purpose. He carried no insurance. I kept telling him, "You got to do this, buddy." And he eventually started taking insurance, and that was when he got tagged for something else, and it was much higher, but we were able to get out on that too. But I don't believe you're required, so I don't think that falls in the standard of care. You must be licensed, though. No, licensing does not require you. So you have to be licensed, and if you're not licensed, then you're actually illegally, so there's a crime. And so you're obviously negligent in that. But and there may be laws in certain states. I'm unaware of them, but I don't think so. So it's stupid, by the way. I do not recommend the I carry no insurance so my lawyers can get me out by saying I'm broke. Don't ever do that. But I've represented one person in my 30 some years of doing that. Then there's some states, including Illinois, have passed statutes to forbid a party from promising to indemnify the other party for consequences for their own negligence. So, like, what happens is Haribo says to you, architect, "You must indemnify me for an injury that's related to your architectural design." Person gets crushed by the vat of candy, sues me, $1 million judgment, and it turns out that some of my negligence was upkeeping the equipment. Because of the law in Illinois, the Anti-Indemnification Act, the architect is not, by law, required to pay any of my negligence. That's why you do the percentage and everything else. I can't be indemnified for my own negligence. If I'm negligent, I got to carry my own freight. And so, like I said, Illinois does that. Many states, I don't know if all states do that, but many states require or limit how much that indemnity is. So, again, it's all about fairness. I mean, some of these things are complex and everything else, but like what I always try to do when I talk to lawyers about indemnity, like, and this will be the conversation I'm going to have with this architect that I'm working on with this project on the East Coast. I'm going to be like, "Dude, I understand you don't have insurance, but what's fair? Why is it fair for my client to carry your damages and your losses?" That doesn't make sense. Like, you try to get back to fairness. You try to get back to the basics of it, and then you craft the language around it. So, indemnity is only available when the liability is derivative being separate and third part brought out. I am absolutely not going to test you guys on this, so I'm just going to go on. But you can ask your question.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to go back to that? Let's go back to that. All right. We can talk about it, but you will not have any question about derivative liability. So. Oh, yeah.
I was wondering, what
the
architect
did
have
a certain sort of
contract? They
strike that contract. He did. And he says, there's two things. There's what's called a duty to defend and a duty to indemnify. And defense means, in indemnify, and what normally happens in an indemnity clause is, I say, not only if I have to pay $1 million, you have to pay that $1 million, you also have to pay my lawyers. Because I wouldn't have been sued if it wasn't for you. So that's the duty to defend versus the duty to indemnify. Many states do not require or require the insurers to pay the duty to defend. Illinois recently changed that. There was a case that came down in December of 2023. Huge, big deal. the Cuda case that says now the duty to defend is an insurable cost. The insurance companies don't want to pay other lawyers. They'll pay their own lawyers. Like if I'm an architect and I hire a lawyer, the insurance company will pay my lawyer because that's the deal. They pay premiums between the insurance company and my architect's lawyer. But that insurance company doesn't want to pay the owner's lawyers. Like why would I want to pay their lawyers? Their lawyers are really expensive and I have to pay now two lawyers. And so the insurance companies over the years have had, in Illinois, had these like, they had it locked down. Texas, completely opposite. The law is changing because it's not fair. Again, I'm terrible. I get sued because this candy guy, the guy gets crushed by candy, and it's not because of my negligence. It's solely because of the design. Why should I have to pay a lawyer? I shouldn't even be in this mix. They should have sued the architect, but they didn't know who they were, so they sued me. So Illinois, in that insurance thing, says we don't pay for those costs, or you may or may not pay for the defense costs. But some lawyers will use that as an example of why they don't want to give indemnity for defense. Like, that's one of the things the other guy's saying, is I'm not paying for your client's legal fees. And he'll be like, but my client wouldn't be sued unless you did this wrong. And I'm going to be like, I'm not going to charge you for my client's legal fees if they did something wrong. It's only for what you did wrong. So, those are the negotiations and everything else. Okay. Insurance. We kept talking about insurance. And insurance, again, I'm going to try to keep this at a very high level for you guys. I'm going to talk about the types of insurance. There's lots on the screen. I'm going to go over the concepts of it. Insurance, I could teach an entire class or an entire semester on insurance. Everybody would fall asleep within the first 10 minutes of each class. I find it fascinating because it's puzzles. And like as an architect and engineer, my previous brain and lifetime, I look at the law as puzzles and how things kind of go together and fit. So insurance and how you cover people and everything else, I find it interesting. But I put it in the lectures here because you guys have to know there's insurance for you guys. It has to be on all your projects. Like I said, you're always going to be asked to indemnify and you always should carry insurance. So I go through it. This class a lot today is more about what you need to learn about being practicing. And that's why it's toward the end of this part of the semester, because it's more of what's real in practice, but it's going to be in every contract. So, professional liability insurance, the first type, that's the insurance you have for your services as an architect. This is the negligence insurance. This is the medical malpractice insurance. This is malpractice insurance if you commit an error or omission. So when you get sued by an architect, most of the time, it's going to be because you screwed up in performing those services. There's the rare occasion that someone comes to your office in January and slips on the snow and ice on your steps and breaks their arm as they fall and sues you because you negligently scrape the ice off and cause their injury. That's a tort claim, not a contract claim. That would not be covered by your professional liability insurance because how you shoveled the walk has nothing to do with your architectural services. That's by another type of insurance which you're going to come up in a couple screens. Professional liability insurance is your insurance for your services. A couple concepts that are important that make it unique as how insurance works. So there's a coverage limit. I got $1 million insurance. I got $3 million insurance. I got $5 million policy. That's what your limits are. So when someone sues you, if you have $3 million limit on your policy, anything that a judgment that comes in under, the insurance company pays. Anything over, you pay. So that limit is something as a business, you're going to be like, what are the risks that I carry in my jobs? How often am I going to be sued for more than $3 million? Do I need to carry a $5 million policy or $3 million? Most architects that I deal with carry $1 million or $3 million. It's starting to change to two from three to five, but most are in that $1 million to $3 million. And then when you get a big company, it could be $25 million. But that's where you're going to be seeing, one to three. Okay? The interesting thing about this policy, though, is the policy limits pay both the recovery of the injury and the attorney fees. So let's say you have a $3 million policy. I've been working for you for a couple of months and I send you a bill for $100,000. Your policy is worth $2.9 million. And every dime I bill against that policy erodes its limit. And so sometimes as an architect, you settle a case because you're like, okay, my attorney spent, it's a big case, my attorney spent $500,000 in legal fees. I think this judgment might be over $2.5 million. I want to settle this case, and so I'm going to go to the plaintiff's attorney. I'm going to say, I'm going to give you 1.7 guaranteed, and we know the insurance company is going to pay that, and then you have a little bit of wiggle room in there. And the other side's going to come back, we need 2.9, and then you negotiate, and all of a sudden you land on 2.3. The lawyer still spent $500,000. You have 2.5 to pay, so you don't have to pay anything out of your pocket. So sometimes, business-wise, architects will settle cases, even if they believe they don't have liability, because the cost of litigating the case will be too expensive, and there's a risk at the end that they're still going to get tagged. I've had cases where $3 million policy, the case was so big and so massive that the architect lawyer projected that the fees would be in excess of $2 million. The architect had very low liability in this action, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000. But they were worried that maybe the lawyer's numbers of $2.5 to $2 million were wrong. So they settled the case almost immediately for like 1.2. They paid way over what their probably ultimate liability was going to be because they didn't want to run the risk and the insurance company was going to pay those dollars. So that limit pays the loss and the attorneys. They're what's called the declining balance or eroding policies. That's that concept they erode. Contractors' policies don't do that at all. It's paid totally separate. The deductible. There is going to be some kind of deductible, too. The architect has to pay something. Like, you have a deductible on your auto insurance. And so of that $3 million policy, the architect may have a $100,000 deductible. So that's something that always will come out of the architect's pocket. There's still going to be the $3 million, but the architect has to kick in $100,000. Maybe $50,000, depending on where those deductibles are. It's a retroactive date. So it's the earliest date of the architect's error or omission for which the coverage will apply. Let me think of how this works. So you have your policy renews every year. Let's just call it January 1st. Sometimes you go from 1 month, 1 year you're at $1 million, and the next year you're $3 million, and the next year $3 million, $3 million. It's going to start your insurance for whatever that value is in that limit. It's going to start on January 1st every year. So you know that whenever the claim is made, it'll be within that year. It's not going to go back to a previous year or anything else. It's going to be within that claim period of when that started, the clock started on that policy for that year. And the premium is the annual payment you're going to pay each year for your premium, how much you know. Like, it's in addition to that deductible, if you get a claim against you, you have to pay premiums, like insurance costs, just that's in every month or every year, depending on how that is, if you pay that. Questions on that? Okay, a little bit more on professional liability. It's what's called a claims-made policy. Two different types of way the insurance companies look at it. Claims-made and occurrence. You design a building in 2024. Your design results in a leaky roof. The roof doesn't start leaking until March of 2025. That's not that bad. People aren't sure what it is. A couple buckets in the gym, whatever it is. So the school doesn't sue you. They have 4 years, remember, from when they knew or should have known. They have 4 years to sue you. You did the design in 24. The lease started in 25. They sue you in 2027. That is when the claim is made. The policy in place in 2027 is the policy that's being used, not the 2024 when you performed the work, not the 2025 when the leak started. It's when the claim is made. And that's a unique type of situation with insurance. Almost all insurance's occurrence policies is when the occurrence happened and you did the design. But with professional liability, architect, lawyer, accountant, doctor, it's a claims-made policy. So, sometimes the claim can be made, the second paragraph here, you may be retiring. Like, I'm done, I'm hanging up my shingle, I'm going to sell the business to somebody else. they get what's called a tail policy. And they say, I'm going to be paying for insurance over the next 5 years just in case something happens on one of my projects. Because if they sue you after the fact and you designed it on your own as an individual, you don't have insurance, it's when the claim's made, but the insurance companies are like, I know you designed it in 24, but you retired in 25, you got sued in 27, you don't have insurance. I'm not paying a dime. So you want to do what's called a tail. Or sometimes you have special projects. So like, let's say, like I've had projects where we really like the architect, and they carry a $5 million policy. And I'm like, this is a big, big project. I need you to carry more. So for that project alone, the architect carries a $25 million policy. All the rest of their projects are $5 million, but just for that project alone, they carry a $25 million policy. The owner pays additional money to amp up the insurance. Project is over, operating. The architect should have factored into its price a tail to keep that $25 million going for 1, 3, 5 years, so they are protected from that candy bat falling at it. Did you have a question? Why the deductible would be higher?
Yeah.
The deductible would be higher has nothing to do with whether they have unlicensed architects. It's solely based on the risk value of the projects. So if you're doing a bunch of $1 million houses, you're not going to have $20 million claims. But if you're doing a bunch of $200 million factories, you're going to have a $15 or $20 million claim in a period of 10 years. And the insurance company has all these tables to say, oh, here's your loss ratio. You've never been sued, so I'm going to lower your premiums, but your deductible is going to stay high. So like the big companies, and these are more on the construction side, but like Bechtel or Turner Construction on their insurance, their deductibles are sometimes $2 million. Because if you get a claim against a Bechtel or a Turner or some huge construction company, it's not going to be a $1 million claim. It's going to be a $20 million claim. And so there are a lot of companies, depending on what their deductible is, they'll settle it outside of making an insurance claim because it's cheaper to settle it than to pay the deductible. So you got a $1 million claim and you got a $1 million deductible, and then you got to pay an attorney. Well, you just pay the $1 million out of your own operating business and you don't have to deal with all that stuff. Those are all business decisions and everything else. So, that's what I talk about here. They could be large for people with large practices or been in business for a long time. How the coverage limits and everything else is how you're claims. And I talk about an auto policy here, but like, let's say you were in a couple car accidents. I mean, State Farm's going to charge you the next time they renew your policy. Your premiums are going to go up, and then they make your deductible go up. Back to your question. Yeah. So what you have to do, well, not the policy. So the question is the kind of practice to disclose insurance policies. So the way it normally happens is you have to provide what's called a certificate of insurance. Certificate of insurance is going to be issued by whether it's the insurance broker or the insurance company themselves. And it's going to say, for this policy period, from X date to Y date, these are the types of insurance and the limits that are in place. And it'll identify your project and it'll identify who's what's called an additional insured and all this other stuff. So that is a guarantee, kind of, that the insurance is in place. You normally don't provide the other side your actual policy because that's a contract between you and an insurance company. An insurance policy, even when you guys get it from State Farm for your car or your house, that's just a contract. That's all it is a contract. And it's got terms and conditions. Now, we never negotiate those terms because you can't do that. But when I work with my coverage lawyers, they negotiate the terms with the insurance companies as to what's covered and how it's covered. Because of that, that's a private document, and I'm not going to be showing it to all the parties that are hiring me. Now, if there's a lawsuit, they may ask for a copy of that, and then there's sometimes motions where it's secretly seen and only certain people can see it. They don't get a copy of it. They get to review it. There's all these different things because it's a private document. So the policy itself is never or rarely given, but the certificate of insurance is. So you see that the insurance is in place. Okay? Oh, and the one other thing you will see is exclusion. There may be, because a lot of policies are pretty standard, so there may be exclusion that says, like, we will not insure for water damages, leaky, like water seepage in a basement. That would be an exclusion to the main policy. It may insure for a roof that leaks and can fall in, but if there's water seepage in an old basement, and when you're getting your homeowners, you're buying a 20-year-old house and everything else, that may be an exclusion. That's on the homeowner side, but there may be exclusions on the architect side. So you will provide the other side exclusions so they are aware of what's not covered from what's kind of generally known. So you'll see limits to the policy, the types of policies, and the exclusions, but not the rest of the language. Okay? All right, so that's for the architect or any professional liability. Oh, one last thing here. Claims must be reported promptly. So if I'm the owner and I had that leaky ceiling in 2025 and I didn't bring the claim until 2027, you and the insurance company may have a defense that says you came too late. Now, your defense is probably less so because they had 4 years of knew or should have known. But the insurance company, let's say you waited. Let's say you got sued in 2027. Or maybe you were called in 2025 and you went and sent somebody out and tried to fix it. It didn't work. And then they sued you in 2027, but you never told your insurance company. If you don't call up the insurance company and say there's a potential or a claim against me, the insurance company can say, I don't have to defend you. Because it's delayed, it's too long. So the other big thing I tell you guys, I tell every architect, is if there's a claim or a potential claim, tell the insurance company right away so they don't have a duty to a notice defense, failure to give proper notice. So there's a lawyer that's going to be hired by the insurance company. So you got the lawyer defending you as the architect for doing bad malpractice. That's what I do. But there's going to be insurance lawyers that only represent insurance companies. And they're going to come in and they're going to defend the insurer and they're going to say, hey, this is why you didn't tell me in time. But then there's this third person. There's this third party. So sometimes I get hired directly by the client. I have been hired by insurance companies to defend them. But a lot of times I get hired by the insurance company to defend the client. So architects get sued. Call the insurance company right away. They do their job, they say their claim, and they say, hey, I have my insurance, you got to take care of this for me. They say, okay, we're going to get you a lawyer. And so some lawyer that I've never worked with calls me up and says, I'm your lawyer for this lawsuit. The insurance company hired me. Because remember, they're getting paid out of the policy. They're like, okay, so you work with them and everything else. But that creates this kind of tripartite relationship. And remember, the insurance companies, they sit up here on their giant thrones and they're worth millions and billions of dollars. Insurance companies never want to pay. So they're going to try every single way against you and against the other side to try to not pay. And the insurance company is hiring a lawyer to represent you. Who do they owe the loyalty to? Who is the insurance company attorney and loyalty if he's representing you? What do you think? Who do they owe? How many people say they owe the insurance company? I know it's on the board. How many people say they owe the architect? Good. So they owe the architect, and that's because, remember I told you under my standard of care, there are model rules that I must zealously defend my client, and my client is the insured. But there has been times where I have been in situations where I tell my client, so I'm being paid by the insurance company, and I'm getting pushback from the insurance company not to do X, Y, and Z. And they're not going to cover you, architect. And so I call up my client, the architect, and I say, you need to hire a separate lawyer to go against the insurance company. And then the insurance company is going to hire a separate lawyer to defend them on coverage issues. And I'm going to continue to defend you on the defense issues. So there's all this kind of machinations how it is. That's why insurance gets really complicated and boring and waving in and out and everything else. But remember that when you get, if you give notice to your insurance company, I got sued, and they send you a lawyer, that lawyer must put you first, even though they're getting paid by the insurance company. Don't ever let them say, oh, I got to do this because of the carrier. You say, no, you're my lawyer. You're not the carrier's lawyer. Practice versus project policies, I talked about this really quickly. When you had that one project, like I talked about, like a factory where they had $5 million and we had them carry $25 million, that's a project policy. Your normal policy that you carry on a day in, day out is your practice policy, because your general practice is my risk is going to be $3 million or less. So everybody that comes to work for me, my fees and everything that's priced out is within that practice policy of what I normally do to practice. But those special projects, I get special insurance just for that project, and it's a project policy. So, the project policy, the typical practice policy covers all claims made by the architect during the course of that policy year. Everything that's out there, okay? If there's a project policy, this is all professionals' liability claims against a design professional arising out of the particular project. And they don't put this half into the practice policy. So if I had a $10 million project policy and I carry a $3 million practice, it's only $10 million on this project. It's not $13. They don't climb on top of each other. Project policies, the premiums for them will be passed on. So when I tell an architect, I want you to carry more insurance, they're just going to build that additional insurance cost, the fees, the premiums, straight into their price for us. And sometimes they'll be like, I want you to carry this insurance, and they come back with a pricing, I'm like, maybe I don't want you to carry that insurance. And you, as the owner, take that risk analysis of how much that costs. Like I said, the practice policy costs are factored into the overhead. So when you bid any project, you're going to say, I pay every single year for my practice policy. Let's try to make it simple. My premiums for a year are $1,000 for a $1 million policy. I do 10 projects a year. So when I put together what I think it's going to cost to design each one of those 10 projects, I add $100 to each one of those final prices, because I take the 10 projects, $1,000 split up, and I add that into my price for what I charge. So the insurance cost is built into your bid to do the work. Everybody will do that every time, and that's the end of the day. Is at the end of the day, the owner, no matter how they may think about it, the owner's always paying for the insurance. As the architect, you want to keep that as a cost, as a pass-through cost. So, and that's why, like, when I told this guy that says he never carries insurance, I'm like, why don't you carry it and just pass the cost to your clients? And he was like, I never thought of that. So we did that. And then he got sued once. It was big. We settled it. But after that, he never got sued. Okay, next one. Commercial general liability insurance. The architect. So commercial general liability insurance is kind of like for everything else. For a contractor, we're going to talk about this in a second. For the architect, it's rare. It never happens. It's like if you trip and fall, and you're in, like I said, you know, when you fall in the snow or something. It's really very inexpensive. You're going to carry $1 million. It's going to cost you, like, I don't know, your premiums will be $5,000 to $10,000 a year. It's going to be very low. Actually, I probably shouldn't be signing premiums because I really don't know what they are. But it's very low because architects are almost never sued under commercial general liability, because the claims against architects are always going to be for their defect in their design, as opposed to you didn't sweep your floor and I slipped on it type thing. That's where that comes in. Commercial general liability policies are occurrence-based, though. It's when the injury happened, not when the claim is made. For contractors, however, it's different. The commercial general liability policy is the big policy that they carry. Many contractors won't even carry professional liability because they have no obligation to design anything. They're not a professional. So this is the big one when you sue a contractor. It's still an occurrence-based policy, and this is going to be worth much, much more. You're going to carry $1 million as an architect. Contractors are going to carry maybe $1 million at the first level, and then they're going to have maybe a $25, $50, $100 million excess policy. So they're going to be carrying huge dollars of insurance under a commercial general liability. It's important to the owner because of the claims between the owner and the contractor, but I say for the architect, it's illusory. It has nothing to do with your services. You will get nothing as the architect out of the commercial general liability policy of the contractor, because it covers their defective construction and their safety and their management and all the stuff that they're supposed to do. Because remember, you're not responsible for safety. You're not responsible for means and methods. You're just the designer. So you get nothing from it. That's why you carry your professional liability insurance. they will often carry an exclusion that says not only is it related to what the contractor does, but we will never pay anything that the architect screws up. So there may be that exclusion. Some are in there, some are not. And then policy claims sudden damages occurrence resulting in property damage, bodily injuries, but not solely economic loss or repair. So we can have, I'm blanking on a specific name. There are some very unique policies that get a contract around an economic loss doctrine for commercial general liability. It's an additional one you put on top. So your commercial general liability as an architect is just somebody trips and falls in your office type thing. Contractor for all their bad construction, bad management, and safety. Auto insurance. You want to have auto insurance because you're going to drive to a project site, even if it's your own car. When you're driving to a project site or when you're on that project site and you hit somebody or you get in an accident, you can be sued or your company can be sued because you're performing services in accordance with your duties as an architect. I'm going to the job site and I got in an accident. So you want to make sure that the company you're working for has auto insurance. And it works just like regular auto insurance, but it's paid for by the company you're working for. They're like a general liability policy, except they cover accidents arising out of the use of the car. They're simply commercial versions of what you guys carry as a personal liability. Different countries have different ways of looking at it, but in the U.S., the basic, if you guys have a car, you've ever had auto insurance, it works the same way. It's just you're probably going to get higher limits covered by your company, and your company's going to pay for it. It's going to be part of your benefits. You will never have to pay for it yourself. And know that when you're performing during your actual services, whether you're an architect or contractor or otherwise, you should be covered by that. Questions on that? Yes, I would have the company pay for the car and the pay for the insurance. Yeah. Yep. I would run all of my insurance. If I had a company and I was doing fine enough, I would have all of that run through the company. Rental of the property, buying your car. You know, you may have another car at home, but your main car that you drive to work to and from, that's owned by the company, that's insured by the company. Even if you're driving, to Ohio on a vacation, it's a company car. And they may try to get around that, but that's what I would do. So, okay. Builder's risk insurance. Builder's risk insurance is a very unique type of insurance that happens on construction projects. Sometimes they call it course of construction. The concept that we have up here is it covers the construction work performed during the project. It can be purchased by either, there shouldn't be a space here, owner or contractor. And the policy names both as insured parties. So it's going to cover, the builder's risk is going to cover both owner and contractor. It's one of the few policies that they are both considered named. As opposed to the contractor buys commercial general liability, they're the named insured and you can add owners. Builder's risk, both parties are covered. And it's no fault. If there's damage that occurs, they're going to pay. And the one thing that says the danger to the architect, builder's risk insurer may pay off a loss and then turn around and sue the architect for having negligently contributed to the problem. So let me explain what could happen in builder's risk. Builder's risk as a concept is, I own a piece of land, I'm going to build a factory on that piece of land. As an owner of the land, I must carry property insurance. So I carry the property insurance. But the property insurance by the property company was for that empty plot of land. As you start to build something, it changes. And the insurance company is not going to keep changing the insurance as the building gets built and built and built. Maybe it takes a year or 2 years to build it. And that property becomes more valuable as you're building more stuff on it. So you got a property piece of land that's worth 20 grand. When it's ended, it's going to have a $1 million building on it. They're going to have huge different values. So during the course of construction, you purchase builder's risk insurance that will cover property damage. Lightning strikes it and the building burns down. You have the builder's risk. Wasn't the contractor's fault, wasn't the architect's fault, wasn't the owner's fault, but you just lost $400,000 worth of construction because it burned to the ground. Or, while the project is in the middle of the night, some people come in and they steal the lumber and they steal the tools and they steal this, and you have loss of equipment. That's going to be a cost that the contractor wants. Not the contractor's fault, not the architect's fault, not the owner's fault, but you have to insure it. So the builder's risk happens during the course of the project. It covers only the four corners of the property. And it protects, and both the owner and the contractor can buy it. And sometimes, if a project is going to be gone over a period of time, you may say the first year the builder's risk policy has a value of $2 million. And the second year, $10 million. And the third year, $30 million because the building's getting built. And it's also going to be a $30 million building. So sometimes it can be, and each year you change your premiums and the risk factor goes and everything else. But it's really important on a project. Like, and one thing, like, you may have seen this. I noticed this just because I'm a construction lawyer and everything else, but you ever driving down the road and you see a construction site and they got the crane, the big giant crane, and there's the long arm, and hanging from that arm is a big box. So, like, you see just hanging at the end, there's this big giant box. You're like, what is that? That's expensive equipment. And they raise and lower that every night because you don't want vandals to come in and steal your sawzalls and everything else. That's why it's hanging up on a crane at 150 feet in the air. Because they are making sure they don't get damage and vandalism. And that helps their insurance policy because they're taking safety precautions. So that's what builder's risk is. Builder's risk is protects the property from loss due to vandalism, acts of God, things that are not caused by anybody else. Now when I talk about this thing, the danger to the architect is... they may say that there was a fire caused by a bolt of lightning, but there was problems with your design that caused the fire to spread. So the insurance company pays the owner all the money for the loss of the building, and they pay the contractor for the loss of the equipment. And you don't think that the architect's in trouble because it got hit by lightning, but it may have been that there was problems with your design that caused things to spread faster or whatever. There's some risk there. It's minimal, and I've been involved in very few insurance cases where you had to have this worry about the crossover for builder's risk, but it can happen. So when it talks about subrogation and other things, we won't get into that. This will be like later on if you ever want to just read this for fun, but that's all you need to know about builder's risk. It's this type of insurance that covers the project during construction. When the project is substantially complete and turned over to the owner, and the building is now worth $30 million, the owner must go back to their property insurance company and say, now I have property that's worth $30 million. I need a policy for my entire property, as opposed to the $30,000 piece of land that I had 2 years ago. And the builder's risk is gone, and the owner's responsible for their own insurance going on because their factory's working or the house is working or whatever it is. Workers' comp. Workers' comp insurance is something that an employer carries on behalf of its employee, and it's for injuries that occur, physical injuries. So I know we've been talking about torts, and they could be for kidnapping and coercion and everything else. Workers' compensation is tied to physical injuries or loss. Each state has a workers' compensation law, and so when you negotiate contracts, you may, actually this goes back to one of your questions. I'll go back to one of your questions. You asked about insurance. Does an architect have to carry insurance? They have to carry workers' comp in most states. There is a law for workers' comp that has to do with people, workers getting injured 100 years ago and everything else. So I believe every state, but I'm not positive, but I know the state of Illinois, you must carry workers' comp for your employees. If they get injured, whether it's carpal tunnel because they've been typing too much at the office, whether they get hurt on the accident, a project on an accident, whatever it might be, the employer will pay a certain amount to the employee for that injury if it's a work-related injury. Now, the interesting thing about that is that's all the employer has to pay. So let's go back to my electrician that gets their leg crushed and it's $1 million leg off. That's how much the claim is to everybody. Workers' comp laws have these tables, swear to God, of what the value of a leg off from the knee down is worth. It may be like $160,000. And so the workers' comp insurance pays out that number because it's got a defined amount. Broken finger, carpal tunnel, they have all these charts and these actuary tables and everything else. And so you get that, and the employer doesn't have to pay any more. So when the judgment comes down for $1 million, the employer says, I paid my $160 through my insurance. I don't have to contribute any more. Even if I was 85% at fault, somebody else has to pay the money to get up to the million, because the employer is limited to the workers' comp. So they must carry workers' comp, to your question, they must carry that insurance, but it is a protection to them because that's their cap. So, workers' comp is the exclusive remedy that they have against their employer. That's all they can claim against their employer. That's why it's only the 160 cap or whatever the value is in the chart. But the injured party can bring tort claims against all the other third parties that may be responsible for. Like I said, damages the employee receives for these processes is usually far smaller than it would get in court from the $1 million versus the 160 or whatever the amount is. It's common for employees to sue everybody. That's why you bring the employer in, but the employer says, I'm only contributing, remember that contribution concept, I'm only contributing my workers' comp value. And then that workers' comp makes it difficult to the party who have been sued by the employee to bring the employer to court to bear its fair share of loss. Unless you can show that the worker, that the employer was acting with egregious, reckless intent, outside intentional tort, that is outside the coverage of the workers' comp, maybe you could show that, you know, if the employer was specifically inflicting that injury on the party, you may be able to get something outside of the workers' comp, but if it's just in the normal course of business, that's what they're limited to. Question?
I'm not quite sure how workers' comp claim goes. Is it going to submit from the worker or from the employer?
It's the worker that submits the claim to the company, and then the company calls its workers' comp carrier. And then there's actually a whole branch of courts that you can go that you just do workers' comp claims. And that they're not in the regular court system because they just... I mean, they're in the regular court system, but there's specific judges that only handle comp claims, at least in Cook County.
So could the worker make their own decisions and not go to the workers' comp and for example, when we were talking about the damages, like the electrician,
yeah.
And then that affects his whole life, and that will result in more money?
But if the employee sues an employer, because the law says the employer must carry workers' comp, then the claim is a workers' comp claim. The employer can't say, I don't want to go through this workers' comp thing. I'm going to sue you and get as much as I can. They just get what the workers' comp pays. Now, if you can show that maybe they're acting outside of what the coverage might be, like I said, if it's an intentional tort or it's reckless regard for the safety of life or whatever, you may be able to get outside of that policy and claim more, but most of the time the claim is just going to be in the course of your work and you have to go by the workers' comp law. So, and like I said, it's specific. I've done workers' comp stuff and it's kind of tragic because there's stuff about it that you're like, that's all you get? And sometimes you don't have the third party to sue. Like the carpal tunnel person that types forever and is, you know, and everything else, and then has to go for medical, blah, blah, blah. They're capped. They don't get anything. They don't have a third party to sue. And so that is good because there is some protection for you, but then it can be limiting to whatever your potential loss is. So, certificate of insurance. This goes back to your question back there, is you give the policy. So what you do is you give the certificate. It approves the insurance where policies were purchased and covered. It's prepared by the broker, sometimes the insurance company, describing the basic terms. Often on a construction project, it's up to the architect to collect, examine, observe all the certificates of insurance, not just provide their own, but as their ministerial duties of doing the project, they have to get it from the contractor and all the subcontractors and be the party that carries these and goes back to the owner and says, you're not properly insured, because that's part of their duties that they do on a project. If there are complex issues regarding coverage arise, you must examine the actual policies. So if there's something really outside of the norm, then you can get the actual policy. As I said, sometimes it's in camera and there's nobody else can see it. In camera means in chambers with the judge. Question?
Yes, sorry.
Sure. Yeah.
What if you hire a temporary agency or a third party and they're not
That's an excellent question. If you're hired by a temp agency and you aren't under that, you need to carry your own insurance, your own liability insurance. It wouldn't be workers' comp because you're just a single individual, because they're going to issue a 1099. And that way you have to pay your own taxes, because the 1099 is just, here's your money. So you're responsible for your insurance, your own taxes, and everything else. And so there are some, however, there are some temp agencies that you work for and you under a retainer contract with them, and you're only exclusive with them. And in there may be some potential benefits that are related to comp or other types of insurance. That's rare. It's the deal you may negotiate. So there's lots of people that work on a contract basis. Or what you do is you negotiate when you go to work for, let's say you get a job with General Motors working on the line, maybe not that one, but I'm trying to think of a, let's say you're a highly skilled, sophisticated craftsman or tradesman, and you go to work non-union, because I can tell you how it works with the union, but you're in a company, you go work, maybe the agency that places you with that high-end wood refinisher company can negotiate that you are under their policy for the period of employment. So there's ways to do that. In states where there's unions, and this is one of the benefits of the union, is the union provides you that. So you do get covered, but you don't have to buy it yourself, and it's part of your union, what's called it your burden rate. And so that actually will be built into your hourly wage. So you may be paid $60 an hour for your journeyman electrician, but the people that are hiring you are charging $140 an hour because you have the $60 an hour plus your vacation benefits, your workers' comp benefit, your commercial general liability, and those are all built into the union wages that are on top of your hourly rate. So there's different ways to protect yourself with that. But if you're just, like, my wife is an independent contractor, she's a writer, so I'm not really worried about workers' comp for her, but I have told her, I'm like, you know, when these companies hire you, we're all covered by my insurance and our insurance, and that's fine. And you know, if she needed comp, I would tell her to get it. So, okay. I think this is it for today on the regular stuff. Any questions on this? Okay. So let's spend a few minutes with